Imagine that for over a decade, you have fought to reach the pinnacle of your profession. Then you walk away. When you return 6 months later, nothing is the same.
I've been screwed by Shawn Michaels. I've been screwed by Stone Cold Steve Austin.
You scratch my back and I'll stab yours.
There is no respect.
Everybody in that dressing room knows that I'm the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be.
Even your fans have changed. At the heart of this change is a man that spits in the face of your every accomplishment.
Ever since you came back, you ain't done nothing but cry.
He has attacked you physically and verbally.
If you put the letter S in front of Hitman, you've had my exact opinion of Bret Hart.
This man mocks your legacy.
Bret Hart on his best day can't lace my boots. I will beat the hell out of Bret, and that's the bottom line.
Injustice after injustice has forced you to snap.
Frustrated isn't the word for it.
Now the finger is pointed at you. You're the one who's changed.
He's snapping, man!
They say your ego is your enemy. There is only one solution. You must make Austin beg for mercy. But what if Stone Cold Steve Austin wins? What becomes of Bret Hitman Hart then?
And welcome to episode 59 of the New Generation Project podcast, where, it's almost time to go to Dallas.
Yeah, almost.
It almost is. There's like nothing left in the way of my life before we have to do that. So,
well, there is a journey to an airport.
Yeah, but that's fine. I can live with that. I mean, like work and life and bills and general life. It's all gone.
Let's get the checklist done. Right. Finished work?
Yes.
Bought everything that you need?
Yes.
Semi-packed?
Yes.
Haircut.
Done your washing?
Done my washing. Need to do a little bit more, but that's fine.
There we go. I think that's all the essentials.
Hang on, there's one more thing we need to do.
What?
Record a podcast about WrestleMania 13.
Oh, yeah. Well, that'll be a brief affair.
It's time to look at arguably one of the most important shows in WWF history and a landmark moment in the timeline of the podcast. Yes, today it's WrestleMania 13.
Woo!
My name is Stuart Brooks, and it's now time for the talent portion of the Miss NGP contest. Our first contestant will break numbers in half with his bare hands. It's Paul Scribbins.
Crack.
Contestant number two will identify women by their breasts blindfolded. It's Adam Wykes.
That sounds like a cracking job.
You won't be able to see them if they're blindfolded.
I know.
But that's his gimmick.
Yeah, there's a tactile experience.
Oh, I thought you just meant you put a blindfold around the breast. I see what you're...
Blindfold a breast?
Breasts can't see.
Well, I know they can't see, but if you put it, some kind of coverage.
You mean like a bra?
Yeah.
If you need this explaining, the gag was that Adam would be blindfolded and various divas would come up in front of him. He would touch their breasts and go, "That's Eva Marie." And then he'd be correct.
And then we'd see him in jail.
Possibly.
No, not if it's part of a sanctioned game.
A part of the talent portion of the Miss NGP contest.
There you go.
How are you both doing?
I'm actually all right.
I'm okay. I don't have to deliberate it about as much as you have to.
How about yourself?
Yeah, cracking. Really looking forward to talking about this, going to Dallas, meeting a bunch of nice people and seeing WrestleMania.
You sound 100% happier than you did last night.
Yeah, I was in a terrible mood last night, but that's what work and grind and life will do to you, Adam.
Exactly, yes. I'm well aware of this.
And I believe you're going on a family holiday with the Scrivens.
Going to Somerset.
Excellent.
Just like, they call it the Dallas of Southwest Britain. I believe.
I'm sure they do.
And there's probably some kind of wrestling going on down there that I probably won't be able to go and see.
Like farmers versus
sheep.
Other farmers.
Possibly. It's like the Godwins.
Versus Hillbilly Jim.
Yeah,
cracking. Before we get cracking today, we've got a couple of bits of business to attend to. Firstly, if you haven't already, head on over to our SoundCloud page to check out a bonus episode exclusively posted there covering WWF Old School 3/16/97, a house show from Madison Square Garden the week before WrestleMania 13. With this episode, our coverage of the WWF in March 1997 becomes pretty damn comprehensive. We've covered the 2 weeks of Raw heading up to Mania, the 1997 Slammy Awards, Mania itself right now, and the aforementioned house show, which you can watch along with us on the WWE Network and listen to us talk about it while you do.
That's like everything that they did in that month.
Well, there's another Raw and some shotguns, but, well, yeah, you know, but pretty comprehensive. Yeah. So if you want to check that out, if you haven't already, go to soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast. Have a listen, watch along, let us know what you thought. Secondly, a reminder that Adam and I, along with hopefully a number of you fine folks, will be at the Ginger Man Pub, 2718 Bowl Street in Dallas on Thursday the 31st of March at 6 p.m. local time. If you're in the vicinity and want to come along and say hello, we'd absolutely love that. If you need any more details, feel free to drop us a message on Facebook and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Or if you want to come but don't really know what we look like, well, I'm sure we'll be posting pictures from Dallas once we're there. So keep an eye on social media.
Maybe you should just do, what you should do on the plane is draw each other.
Yes. Artists' impression of each other, and then they can try and identify us by those pictures.
Or look for Ronnie O'Sullivan and the man standing next to him.
That was my joke I was about to do.
Beat you to it.
Bastard. Are you excited now for WrestleMania, Adam? Because your general excitement levels in life remain fairly level.
They do. It's level at the minute.
But at what reading? Is it level
10.
At a high reading or a low reading?
Well, you can imagine it's got positive and negative integers to it. It's around, hovering about like the zero, the kind of level.
Well, if you want to suck up the joy from Adam,
yeah.
If ginger, you wanna... gingerbread man, is it ginger man? Gingerbread man.
Ginger man.
The ginger man. Go there and wake him up.
If you want to meet someone who's completely ambivalent about everything,
yeah. Well, no, I need to be a bit closer to events before I get that interested.
We fly on Monday. It's now Friday afternoon.
Oh, no, we've still got a weekend to go.
You can imagine him just before a bout of coitus.
Which is more than we can say for you.
Anyway, there must be one thing you're looking forward to over that weekend. Tell everyone.
Still probably Hall of Fame.
Okay.
I think for some reason, I just think that will be a more interesting thing. Because we've been to wrestling shows.
Yep.
But this will be different, although still very, very wrestling themed.
Yes. I'm quite surprised by that. I thought you'd take the beer.
Oh, I'm very interested in beer, yeah. But, I mean, I can get a beer in my living room. I can't
get a Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do an NGP Hall of Fame and see who out of the three of us gets inducted first.
Paddy for his guest appearance.
Yeah, possibly.
Beware of Dog,
he'd go,
was it?
He'd yeah. go in the celebrity wing.
Excellent. That sounds cracking, and then we'll give a 20-minute speech where we talk about our mums,
yeah.
And then, I don't know, Vince has to come out and push us off stage to let Paddy come and do his speech.
What about yourself? I'm guessing it's the NXT thing for you.
It's probably the NXT show, yeah, although...
That big shop.
Yeah, the big shop as well, I'm very much looking forward to. Okay, the Mania card itself looks a bit questionable, but being in that stadium with somewhere around 100,000 people yeah. will be quite incredible. Evolve, I'm really looking forward to. So getting to see Zack Sabre, Mighty Skrull, Will Ospreay, all those guys over in the States will be really cool, I think. Mm. And yeah, the Ginger Man thing should be really good. Mm. Everyone I've met at shows that has listened to the show and come and said hello have always been super nice and really good to talk to. So it will be nice to spend an evening with some people just having a proper conversation and stuff.
That will be wonderful.
And meeting some of our transatlantic friends as well. So unbelievable levels of excitement from me right now.
And just a little fact for you, 100,000 people, it's a tenth of a million.
Brilliant. In honour of Todd Pettingill's two Slammy Award medleys, this week's challenge to you, the audience, was to alter some song lyrics to help us write our own wrestler-related song parody medley. This was an especially difficult one, I think, so many thanks to everyone who had a go. There was also, if you want this week's chart of people are angry at, it's Roman Reigns, still in there, Vince McMahon and Sonny, and Shawn Michaels were, I would say, the most popular topics of parody.
All right.
The following are our favourite suggestions. P2 Polonen, and this is to the tune of The Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, good song.
Do you know that tune?
Is it silent?
No, there are sounds.
But how does that work?
You know what I'm singing, don't you?
I know what you're singing, yes.
And it goes, "Hello, Ahmed, our old friend. He's come to yell at us again. with his wooden plank wildly swinging and the nation gently weeping, and the impact from the dive planted in his brain still remains within the sound of Ahmed.
Very nice, very nice.
Yeah. I've had to alter some minor lyrics here and there for offensiveness.
To be more offensive or to be less offensive?
A little bit less.
Okay.
Tone it down.
John Campbell, to the tune of Karma Police by Radiohead.
Adam's a big Radiohead fan.
Only for like two albums,
yeah,
though,
the Benz and OK Computer.
Yeah, yeah. Which I think are absolutely fantastic. After that, I think they kind of...
One good song, 2 + 2 = 5, I really like. That's one of the later songs that I
actually
like.
How do you feel about that, Scrivens?
No.
Also, there's an EP around the time of OK Computer, Airbag, How Am I Driving? That's really good, if you've never heard that.
No, I'm not. Okay. Well, this one would be Legion of Doom. Take out Farouk. His nation men are making me want to puke. That traitor Savio is going down. This is what you get. This is what you get. This is what you get when you mess with Ahmed.
Brilliant. Love it.
Very nice.
Yeah, that was cracking.
Maybe we should sing these and then see if people can guess the tunes that were intended.
No.
Joe Dudley McCoy, to the tune of Fear of the Dark by Iron Maiden.
Ooh. See, allocating these to each of you was for one person easy and one person difficult. I was unaware of what songs you, Paul, would and wouldn't know.
Most of them.
Right. Well, I figured Iron Maiden was a safe bet.
Yes.
And your second suggestion, I think it is.
Yeah, it is, although, yeah, well, I'll go. Okay. Fear of the Dark. Fear of the dog. I'm bizarre. Where's my title shot?
That was very good.
That was cracking. Yeah. Stephen Cummins, to the tune of the DuckTales theme.
Woohoo.
Things are going really great here in Vince World. Take a Vader, even Sid. They're all over. Might have great wrestling, but one thing's missing, Sean Smile. Woohoo! Out there, all we're looking for is Sean Smile. Woohoo! We're hoping that he finds it somewhere. Sean Smile. Woohoo! Bret Hart wants your title. Even Stone Cold wants to fight you. What to do? Just say that you've lost, Sean Smile. Woohoo! Won't drop the title clean because we've lost Sean Smile. Woohoo!
That was a long one.
There was more of it. I've had to cut some down, but that is amazing.
I used to like DuckTales.
Look, DuckTales are a fantastic cartoon. Really, and Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers.
Yes.
Very early this morning, I was just listening to like those theme tunes on YouTube.
You like the Chip and Dales?
Chip and Dale.
Oh, Chip and
Rescue
Dale.
Rangers.
Okay.
Matthew Gregory Major, to the tune of Don't Speak by No Doubt.
You like No Doubt, don't you?
I like Tragic Kingdom. I thought it was really good. But you know what? I bought the best of No Doubt, and some of it's really good, but they kind of turn into Britney Spears at a certain point, which is
a bonus.
Which I guess I quite liked as well, but it was just really strange.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the first word for this doesn't actually go into the song.
Okay.
So it'd be, Steph, don't speak, your voice is really grating, we don't care what you're saying, your promo's much too long. And you know what? I've got a new respect for that, because last night I watched the edited 1 hour of Raw.
Yeah.
From a week ago, because TiVo had recorded it, and I wanted to see what was going on as we're going over to watch some wrestling. And
I came over and told him off for watching Raw.
Fucking hell. Yeah, she just goes on and on and on. And I quite like Steph, but I don't need to hear 20 minutes of her talking.
But yeah. Then we watched Aztec Warfare, and that was way better.
Yeah, that was dead cool.
Is Vicky Guerrero still knocking around?
No, she left. She's got like a degree in pharmacy or something and married some other bloke.
Okay.
Yeah. She's a pharmacist?
Something like that. I might be wrong, but it's nice. Something. Lawyer, don't know.
She could. Oh, be lawyer, because she could just go, excuse me.
She could.
Great. James Holman, to the tune of Let It Go from the Frozen soundtrack. Doesn't say which version.
Now, you know this particularly well, don't you, Paul?
I do. I'm not sure how to fit some of these words to it, so I thought I might just sing the original.
Okay.
Okay. Snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looked like I'm the queen. The wind is howling like the swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I've tried. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Cause still don't feel, don't let it show. But now they know. Let it go, let it go. What do you reckon?
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Do you want to read out the actual
lyrics? I'll read it. That's the tune, I believe it should be. Okay. I'll try and do it. I'm not sure. The first bit I think will be okay, but I'm not sure how to do the last bit. Horowitz, Horowitz, I can't hold it back anymore. Horowitz, Horowitz, where did that push go? I don't care what they're going to say. The mullet deserved it anyway. But I guess Vince thought you were... Oh, my phone's gone off. But I guess Vince thought you were Jewish anyway. There is a PS here from James Holman. I don't hold the same view as Vincent Kennedy McMahon regarding Jewish people, it says.
Fair enough.
So this one's by Graham McPherson. I'm going to see if you can guess this one, Adam, actually, because I think you'll be able to guess this one.
All right.
I was the man, I lost to Sheik, which unfortunately kick-started Hulkamania. I did not belong in an era of cartoon characters. Just shut your mouth, how can you say? I go about things the wrong way. I am Backlund and I need to be loved, just like everybody else does.
How soon is now?
I am the son and the heir of the lineage of United States presidents. I am the son and the heir of presidential trivia. Just shut your mouth. How can you say I go about things the wrong way? I am Backlund and I need to be loved just like everybody else does. There's a show if you'd like to go. You could sign something for somebody who really loves you. So you go and you sit on your own and that fan goes for food and you go home and you cry and you want to die. When you say that you want a signature now, when exactly do you mean? See, I've already waited too long. And now your chance is gone.
There's good, great songs. Well.
There's an excellent video that somebody sent us on Facebook. I should have posted it by the time we get this out. Backstage footage, or not backstage, but footage from the WrestleMania 13 weekend in a hotel of Bob Backlund talking to fans. It's about 13 minutes long, and it's just him talking about like various different things. It's really interesting.
Oh, cool.
Give us a snippet of gold from it.
Talking about how the reason he says he turned on the fans was because for 10 years they believed a man who lied to them. Hulk Hogan.
So that's like a legitimate...
Someone asked him as well, this bit's brilliant, about how he said he couldn't hear without his glasses, and he says, yeah, that's exactly what I meant. I have a really tiny hearing aid in the back of my glasses. Love some Bob Backlund. Probably going to buy his book to read on the plane.
Scott Hardy, to the tune of This Charming Man by the Smiths. I'll struggle with this one. I would job tonight, but I haven't got a shirt to tear. This man said, well, brother, someone in this Vader's match should pin Flair. I can't work it out, that last line actually goes in. Yeah. You know. Yeah, like a bit of the Smiths.
Yeah.
If we do something like this again, maybe we should see if people can upload some audio files.
Yeah, that would be brilliant.
Yeah, save me doing it. Right, but this is good fun. Rob Hills, to the tune of Dancing Queen by ABBA, one of my favourites.
Well, that's why I thought you'd know this.
Yeah. I'm tempted to stand up, but
I'm
the microphone...
I'm tempted to turn your mic down.
Yeah, it might be worth it. Right, okay, I'm going to go for this. You're the playgirl queen, dodgy knee now, retiree. Playgirl queen won't be beat on the pay-per-view, oh yeah. He won't job. He won't lie, having the worst time of his life. Mind that knee, small's lost, you see, crying the playgirl queen. Da-dink, da-dink, da-dink.
Very good, Scrivens.
That is brilliant. Chris Palmer might be my new favourite person in the entire universe, because he has written this one to the tune of The Last of the Famous International Playboys by Morrissey.
Yeah.
And it goes a little something like this. Dear Shawn Michaels in rehab, with all the new drugs that you are injecting, Oh, I can't help jobbing to you, because everything that you say about your knee must be true. And now to San Antonio, a smile followed you, and here's a list of who you screwed. Bret Hart, Montreal, do you know his name? Oh, don't say you don't. Please say you do. Please say you do. He is the last of the famous stripping professional wrestling boy toys. That is brilliant. I did a terrible job of it, but that is brilliant.
Oh, another great song as well.
Yeah, one of my favourite Morrissey songs.
All right then, Joe Powell, to the tune of Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen.
How come I didn't get that one?
Mummy, I just buried Taker, put my claw into his mouth, pushed and pushed till he was out. Mummy, his hand pushed out the grave. Now he's coming this way, holy shit. Mummy, ooh.
Where the wind blows.
Didn't mean to make you cry. If I'm not back again this time tomorrow.
Hire the executioner.
Carry on, carry on. But don't lose the urn.
Why don't they still do these? These could be great. Someone should do this at the Hall of Fame or to Open Mania. Fuck the national anthem. They probably won't let me in the country now.
Lee Carlos Cunningham, to the tune of Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. don't know if you've heard of it. I'm not quite sure how to do this. I know the song, but right, okay. Sonny, she's not my lover. She's just a girl that I Skype when I'm drunk. But the kid is not Adams.
Has she got any kids?
No. That would be a terrible idea. Taylor Adams, to the tune of the Trapdoor theme.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant.
Was that the kids' cartoon Trapdoor?
Yeah, it was on like Ghost Train on a Saturday morning. It was like Plasticine, wasn't it?
I literally know the name, but nothing else of it.
Trapdoor was brilliant. Stay away from that manta. You're a fool if you dare. Stay away from that manta. He's got horns in his hair.
I'm not sure about this next one.
What is it?
You look like you had a really tricky pink to pot then. Yeah.
It's perfect day.
Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with Drew.
Galloway.
Oh, what a perfect day. You just leave me hanging on. You just leave me hanging on.
Right. So it's the chorus then, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking it was the verse for some reason. I was like, I can't really work that out. Okay, so Nick B, to the tune of Perfect Day by Lou Reed. Oh, it's the Pearl River Plunge. Flying Johnson, get out of the way. Oh, Armid, we love you so much. No, can't understand a word you say. And then there's loads of, no, we can't understand a word you say in brackets after it.
That's fine.
Tyler Good, to the tune of Play That Funky Music, White Boy, by White Cherry. Show the funky stats now, Paulie. Ready for the math test. Show the funky stats now, Paulie. Lay down the numbers and use that calculator till you die.
That was actually pretty good for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Adam Lewis, to the tune of Psycho Killer by The Talking Heads.
Oh, nice.
Another one of my A favourite bands and B favourite songs.
Jessica say?
I can't seem to talk to the cameras. I'm tall and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep because my ankle's all fucked. Don't touch me, I'm a half-brained man. Psycho Sid. Keska say, far better run, 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 run away.
Very nice.
Very nice.
Yeah. Richard Query. To the tune of Golden Brown by The Stranglers. D'Lo Brown, that's my guess. Could be Henry, could even be Test. From far away, it's hard to say. I never know now, is that D'Lo Brown?
That was 5 stars. Excellent.
Drew Mitchell, to the tune of The Wonderwall by The Oasis.
Okay.
I said maybe. This is just a little bit crazy. Is that Elder Sound in Manchester?
Yeah, I thought that was your man catch.
Oh, sorry.
I said maybe. This is just a little bit crazy. And if I'm wrong, I'll get powerbombed.
Scott Cavaliero, to the tune of the American Males theme.
Oh,
American males, American males, American males, American males, American males. It says if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Well done, well done.
That's really clever.
Yeah.
James Wolford, to the tune of Creep by Radiohead. Lola's a creep.
Oh, no, I think you should stop.
He's a weirdo. What the hell's he doing here? The seesaw's around here.
I may have changed a word in that one. But brilliant.
Sam Hayden, to the tune of Run to the Hills by The Iron Maiden.
Heartbreak Kid came on the scene. He broke a window, which turned him heel. He fought Bret Hart, he fought the Click. He lost his smile, he jobbed out Sid. But when it came to take a loss, he moped around and threw a strop. Riding through the stars and barren ways.
Get that column in baseline.
Well, that was fucking fantastic. You guys are all actual geniuses and, yeah, and never fail to impress. As always, incredible thanks to everyone who contributed, especially on this particularly difficult challenge. And if anyone WWE-related is remotely listening, you should totally do these today with random selections of songs like the Trapdoor theme added into them.
Yeah, yeah.
And just to say that we quite enjoyed WrestleMania 13, and see you next time.
Who's like a modern-day Todd Pettingill who could do this on a show?
Make Renee Young do it.
Or Lillian Garcia. She's a singer. She's got songs out.
Yeah, but she could then actually sing, whereas I don't think Todd kind of could.
I think he was all right. He was all right. Yeah. The Road Dog's still there, right?
I think we were better.
Oh, okay.
Me, mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. It's Sunday, the 23rd of March, 1997, and we are live from the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago, Illinois, in front of a crowd of 18,197, including 1,730 comps, for a live gate of $837,150, making it the largest gate in North America since WrestleMania 10 at Madison Square Garden in 1994.
Huh.
On the flip side, the show drew a 0.77 buy rate, around 237,000 buys, for a company gross of $2.4 million, considered by the company to be a disaster and continuing the trend of the big show's declining buy rate. WrestleMania 11 in 1995 drew a 1.5, followed by WrestleMania 12 in 1996 drawing a 1.2. Rubbing even more salt into the wounds is the fact that the previous weekend on March 16th, WCW drew a 0.89 for their Uncensored event, a show which I'm sure we're all aware is historically terrible.
Yes, we've seen that. Yeah. That surprises me, actually, with the work that's gone, because obviously we've seen so much of it, the work that's gone into build-up for this, I think there's a lot of, there should be a lot of interest in it.
It surprises me that it drew less than the 96 show,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. There's more on offer, isn't there?
Yeah, and the In Your Houses have been drawing pretty poorly, but you would assume WrestleMania, the name value alone, would sort of carry it.
Yeah.
This is the bottom of that curve.
So it's uphill from here?
It's uphill from here. Next year's will do a lot more.
Okay.
But interesting that this is very much kind of a low point WrestleMania buy rate-wise, contrasted with the importance of what's actually going on screen.
Mm.
And yeah, why would you buy Uncensored instead of this, especially if you watch the 96 one?
Oh, I wouldn't.
I don't know.
Just goes to show how much of a role WCW are on. They can even sell shit pay-per-views.
Maybe there's a lot of superstitious people out there who wouldn't buy a number 13 pay-per-view.
Maybe. Maybe that's why Taker tried to rechristen it WrestleMania the 13th. Possibly.
But it's quite interesting. Did you hear about the lottery?
I've heard about it. Oh, that multiples of seven thing.
Well, have you heard what happened?
That the numbers that came out were basically like 7, 14, 21, 28, something like that, and came up in multiples of seven, and that's what loads and loads of people do because the lucky number seven do multiples of it. So instead of the guaranteed £25 payout for getting three numbers, they paid out 15.
Yeah.
Bastards.
So
which
yeah.
would
so,
piss you off something rotten.
Yeah, people who got five balls actually got less than people who got three balls.
Wow.
Which just seemed... I still can't get my head around it. Like, why have they not ironed out that flaw in the system? They've not thought it through.
It's providing mathematic difficulty for you.
Yeah, well, it just doesn't make sense. So... Yeah.
Well, I guess there's probably loads and loads of tickets who have, from the very, very start, just had the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Mm. Well, they are statistically just as likely to come out as anything
else. But because
so
many people would have had that sequence of numbers, if they ever came out, then it'd have to be shared out between so many people that you get a much reduced amount.
That's why I went 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah.
In a match held on the free-for-all, which, yet again, is not included on the disc or on the WWE Network, Billy Gunn defeated Flash Funk in 7 minutes and 5 seconds. No, really. The Wrestling Observer writes that Billy won with a swinging DDT from the top rope, which sounds incredibly dangerous, more so when you consider Billy Gunn doing it.
I'm glad we didn't see that.
It's traditionally the grandest night in the World Wrestling Federation. WrestleMania, the great spectacle, the granddaddy of sports entertainment. A magical night where dreams become reality, where legends stand immortal, where incredible feats of athleticism are indelibly etched in the annals of time. But this year, a tempest engulfs Utopia. This year, clouds of hatred and anger have eclipsed the heavens, shed darkness upon the gods. We've watched as our heroes step down from their pedestals, witness malicious attacks by a depraved nation, beheld the dark, disturbing flashes from a once benevolent force. Tonight, three determined men unite to wage war against an evil nation. Their battleground, the cold, unforgiving streets of Chicago. Tonight, two giants of the WWF appear willing to shed their noble armor, to embrace their dark sides, to possess the coveted gold. And tonight, two angry young men destined to destroy each other will endure intolerable pain in a brutal submission match. It's WrestleMania, the showcase of the immortals, the greatest night in sports entertainment. It's supposed to be a night of celebration, a time to rejoice. But tonight, none of these men are smiling.
We open with a video package talking about how WrestleMania is traditionally the grandest night in sports, but this year, a tempest engulfs Utopia. Clouds of anger have eclipsed the heavens, shed darkness upon the gods. A bit melodramatic.
It's wrestling.
I get what they're going for.
A little bit. I put that it is nice to see Jenny McCarthy's knockers getting another outing.
Of course it is. It plugs the top three bouts on the card, with Austin Brett receiving the main event billing ahead of Taker and Sid.
I did think that was a bit strange.
It's WrestleMania, the showcase of the immortals. It's meant to be a time of celebration, but tonight, none of these men are smiling. PlayStation presents WrestleMania 13.
But apparently there's two angry young men.
Brett and Steve Austin, I believe.
Yeah, but it could be that, like, Adam and...
George.
Well,
now you've got Calgary's maddest man. FYI, this is the first time since WrestleMania 2 they've not gone with Roman numerals for the name of the show. So it's just straight 13. I thought this was a pretty decent video package that actually encapsulates what's going on at the time. And I'm glad to see it didn't feature Shawn Michaels, despite his sort of wandering down to the ring at the end of the go-home Raw.
Mm.
Yeah, it was decent.
Oh, it did what it needed to do.
Pyro explodes and Vince McMahon welcomes us to WrestleMania 13 in the Rosemont Horizon in suburban Chicago, as Vince calls it.
Suburban
Chicago.
Shocking.
Jim Ross chimes in, plugging the three titles on the line and the Chicago street fight. Jerry Lawler is there also, but takes his time saying something. And Vince questions whether JR is broadcasting in English.
Mm. Well, they point out their different announce desks for the evening, which is good, just in case I wanted to listen to Ray Rougeau, who seems to talk about WrestleMania 10.
What, was he saying 10 in French?
I'm sure. He just goes over to say, and Vince says, and here's the French announce team, here's Ray Rougeau, and I'm sure he just goes, WrestleMania 10. So I don't know if he's just like a few years out, or I misheard, which is
maybe
a
like WrestleMania 3 was the first one in France, I don't know.
Yeah, but it could well have been.
Our opening bout is a fatal four-way tag team match pitting the Headbangers against the Godwins, against the New Blackjacks, against Furnace and LaFon.
Bit weird.
It's good to see Furnace and LaFon still haven't got a name.
It's good to see they've got some snazzy jackets, though. Mm.
Believe it or not, this match actually received some semblance of build, though it's pretty much confined to Shotgun Saturday Night, which has become the promotion's secondary show, replacing the long-running WWF Superstars, which changed formats to being a weekly recap show. On the February 22nd show, the New Blackjacks interrupted a match between the Godwins and the Headbangers, causing the DQ after attacking Henry and Phineas. Following the show's commercial break, the bout had been changed to the Headbangers against the Blackjacks, but that would also go to a disqualification when the Godwins returned the favour attacking Windham and Bradshaw.
Okay.
The following week's March 1st show would rather logically see the Godwins and the Blackjacks face off, and although the Headbangers wouldn't interfere, we would still get a rather curious finish. The Godwins would pick up the win via reverse decision after Windham switched places with Bradshaw and pinned Henry. A second referee would alert the original official of this injustice, with the Blackjacks attacking the Godwins, although Henry and Phineas would clear the ring of their foes.
Right.
Convoluted.
On the March 15th Shotgun, Doug Furness and Philip LaFon would be dragged into the equation when their bout with the Headbangers went to a double countout when all four men brawled outside the ring. Finally, on the 22nd of March edition, aired the night before this show, a singles match between Blackjack Bradshaw and Henry Godwin would also go to a no contest when the Headbangers attacked Furness and LaFon, who were viewing the bout from the stage, spilling into the ring, causing all four teams to brawl. The number one contender stipulation was added to the bout a couple of weeks before the show, with announcers Jim Ross and Jim Cornette discussing it on the MSG house show that we watched from a week before Mania.
Okay.
This is a bit much.
At least they've bothered to do something to set it up, I guess.
I suppose so. Even with that in mind, I don't care massively about this.
It sounds a bit formulaic and a little bit like I wouldn't want to bother watching any of those shows.
Although we've seen the New Blackjacks a couple of times now, we've yet to give them a proper introduction. So let's see how they came to be. Following his confusing elimination from the free-for-all match back at Survivor Series, you remember that?
Not at all.
Bradshaw got pinned, didn't really get pinned, got told off for it backstage. Like Helmsley earlier in the year, Justin Hawk Bradshaw was left to endure a punishment that was not entirely his fault, i.e. the end of his singles push. With the Stalker being a pretty much dead-end gimmick and Steve Austin exposing him for just being Barry Windham anyway, the WWF looked to put them together as a tag team due to their shared lineage, Windham being the son of Blackjack Mulligan and Bradshaw being the nephew of Blackjack Lanza. On the 29th of December 1996 episode of Superstars, Bradshaw would wander to ringside during the Stalker's bout with Phineas Godwin, telling the Stalker how he looked stupid in his gear, but failing to point out the same thing to Phineas. Pig would pick up the win after the Stalker took his time to taunt Henry Godwin, with Bradshaw returning to the ring to attack the Godwins after the bell. The Stalker would then make the save for the Godwins, shoving Bradshaw away, with Bradshaw trying to speak with the Stalker again in the aisle before Windham pushed him away again. Over a month later, on the February 2nd Superstars, a promo aired featuring Blackjack Lanza claiming that the Blackjacks will ride again, with their first appearance being the previously mentioned attack on the Godwins on Shotgun.
Wow.
I can see why no one bought WrestleMania if this all bollocks is going on.
This is the opening match, all right?
Yeah, all right.
What do you make to Windham and Bradshaw as a tag team?
They look the part. Sort of similar build.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
You know, very similar moustaches.
Are they real moustaches?
They do look fake.
They look like fake comedy
ones.
They
look too good to be real.
But I can't see. I mean, they must be really firmly glued to the face if they are. So
it'd be really embarrassing if your moustache fell off mid-match.
That would be embarrassing.
Or it went crooked.
Or somebody in the match worked over the moustache.
With a comb?
Yeah.
Let's assume that possibly then they are real.
Yeah, okay. But exactly who would you want to come out first at WrestleMania?
What, out of the ones on offer?
Well, just in general.
Just in general, Daniel Bryan. Right.
Well, the Godwins in this instance, of course. Vince is impressed with Henry's handshake, less so Phineas's. While the Godwins wander around the ring, Vince introduces, the French and Spanish announce teams. The Headbangers are out next, legging it down to the ring as JR explains the rules of the match. When a man is defeated, his team is eliminated and the last remaining team is the winner.
And you can tag anyone.
I hate these bloody matches. I know. We've seen a few of them now, haven't we?
Why they haven't cleared that up yet, that partners like facing each other and pinning each other just makes zero sense whatsoever.
Yeah, it's the physical contact thing, is that they've got to wrestle each other. Well, can't they just like shake hands and then go tag somewhere else?
Mm. Did you spot the King being truly astounded by the fact that a headbanger could tag a Godwin? Like, no. Just wrap your head around that for a second. Furness and LaFon head out next to sadly very little reaction, as Vince reminds us that the winner of this match will get a shot at the tag team champions the next night on Raw. 5 minutes into the biggest show of the year, and we're using it to plug the free TV show the next night.
Mm.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, the new Blackjacks would like nothing better than to have a shot at that WWF title Monday night on Raw is War. Your strategy going into this matchup?
That's right. Tonight, we will be victorious in the Blackjack tradition. And then after that, we will be the next WWF tag team champion. Big guys line up, little guys bunch up. Come get your stuff, because the Blackjacks, ride again.
Come on. We see footage of the old Blackjacks before going to Todd Pettingill, who is stood by with the new Blackjacks. And my note here says, their moustaches look fake. We've established they're real. They cut a fairly unremarkable promo with Bradshaw probably doing the better job before heading to the ring.
Oh, I said, yeah, it was tepid. Well, quite like seeing the old footage, though.
I wondered about the entrance. It almost looked to me like they had to duck to get through the entranceway. That would be some kind of design flaw.
It would be, especially because... like Sid's got to come out of it.
Bigger
later.
People.
Yeah.
It does look a bit like they do after Doug. I might be wrong.
I quite like their music, though.
Yeah, the
music. Blackjack music was pretty cool.
I'm a big fan of the LOD music.
The Blackjacks bound into the ring and a brawl with all eight men immediately erupts, but disperses very quickly. We're left with Henry Godwin and Bradshaw in the ring. Henry hits a whopper clothesline to start the show before tagging in Thrasher. Bradshaw hits a big boot to Thrasher, followed by a pump handle slam and a tag to Phineas, who Bradshaw shoves for good measure. Phineas gets a back body drop before tagging Mosh, and yes, old joy, we haven't worked out this stupidity yet. Despite having had well over a year to drop this dumb partners have to fight each other stipulation in this type of match. The headbangers hit each other lightly before banging bottoms and dancing.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the headbangers.
I'm also not a big fan of the headbangers.
How do you feel about the headbangers?
Not a massive fan.
I preferred them as nuns.
I did, but like, honestly, I preferred them as nuns.
Mm.
Thrasher tags Philip LaFon as Vince speculates what the headbangers were up to, with Jerry Lawler offering that Vince knows nothing about rock music. His favourite group is Mount Rushmore.
I quite like that.
Yeah, oh, that's quite clever, yeah.
Didn't he say something about a Big Mac as well? He thinks Fleetwood Mac is a new burger at McDonald's.
Yeah, that's later on, but yeah.
I would have a Fleetwood Mac.
I know you bloody would. That might be one of my favourite Jerry Lawler lines of all time, actually.
He's quite good on this, I think, overall, Jerry Lawler.
It's one of those things that I kind of like him best when he's doing those kind of very innocent... it's not an innocent joke, but like there's no real...
venom.
Yeah.
Basically like a Ken Dodd stand-up.
Yeah. It's just not offensive and not, you know, not attacking Helen Hart or...
anything like that.
Yeah.
LaFon gets a double pancake from the headbangers for a small reaction. LaFon responds with a suplex and a kick before Mosh tags Wyndham, who immediately walks into a nice Northern Light suplex from LaFon for a two count.
Yeah. He does do that well.
LaFon tags Furness, who hits a jumping Hurricane Rana for a two for the biggest reaction of the match so far.
That, I've got to say, was an amazing move. He did it on the last show that we watched, the...
House show,
which was good, but yeah, really good.
A second attempt sees Wyndham catch Furness and hit a power slam. Wyndham tags Bradshaw and the Blackjacks hit a double shoulder block. Bradshaw looks for the sort of clothesline that might decapitate someone, but thankfully Furness ducks and he kicks Bradshaw, who falls to the outside. Furness tries to suplex Bradshaw back in, but Wyndham blocks it and Bradshaw sloppily suplexes Furness to the outside.
Mm. It's more like they tumbled down.
In a sort of suplex-type fashion.
In a sort of suplex heap.
The Blackjacks and Furness and LaFon begin brawling on the outside, where Bradshaw shoves the referee, which Vince describes as a stupid manoeuvre. It is, as it causes the Blackjacks to be disqualified at 4:37.
Yeah, that'll be a good way to just get a team out. Good idea.
And also...
for absolutely no fucking reason, yeah. Furness and LaFon are sent to the back. A quick check says apparently they were counted out at 5 minutes, but I don't remember seeing a count after the DQ started.
Oh, I think there's a lot of boos at this because you've just taken the balls out of this match.
Yeah.
Because, let's be fair, this is going to be a tepid match at the start anyway. And I thought the one thing that could save it, okay, let's we'll give these other guys an opportunity to get a couple of nice spots in. And then, who do you want working the most this match? You want the Blackjacks and you want Furnace and Lafond, who could probably put something competent and nifty together. No, let's get rid of them after like 4 minutes. And
we can have Mosher versus
Thrasher. Or... Yeah.
Well, my next note, yeah, says, if you'd have asked me which teams do you not want this to come down to, my answer would have been the Godwins and the Headbangers. So obviously that's what we're left with. The crowd boos the bullshit finishes. In the ring, Phineas gets a two count on Thrasher before hitting a standing vertical suplex, about the most impressive thing he's ever done, but it does cause Thrasher's skirt to cover his face.
Yes.
That's an attire malfunction.
Well, it's that whole thing that actually got one of the biggest reactions of this match, wasn't it? That it got laughs on the crowd.
The suplex gets Phineas a two, broken up by Mosh. Attack to Henry, who botches a corner spot with Thrasher, where presumably Thrasher was supposed to move but didn't, so Henry gets to look like a dumbass when he stops inches away from charging into the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that where he just shoves him back into it?
Yeah.
Clearly quite pissed off.
Henry tags Phineas as the crowd are pretty much silent. So Phineas and Thrasher spit in each other's faces.
Well, that always gets the crowd going, doesn't it?
Phineas gets a clothesline in the corner before a tag to Henry, who gets a two off a splash. Thrasher tags Mosh, and Henry quickly clotheslines Mosh and himself to the outside. Mosh makes it back into the ring first and drops Henry neck first over the top rope when he attempts to return. Henry gets up on the apron once more, with Mosh this time springboarding over the top rope, hitting a sort of crossbody to knock Henry off the apron.
That was kind of all right.
Thrasher ascends to the top turnbuckle, where Mosh rocket launches into Henry on the outside. It yields little reaction.
They're throwing each other around like darts, exclaims one of the commentators.
Phineas clapping for Henry gets more appreciation from the crowd. Jerry Lawler asks Vince if he has any White Zombie CDs, with Vince asking if they've ever played with Tony Bennett. And this is when you get the "you think Fleetwood Mac is a new hamburger at McDonald's" line.
Well, yeah, if he doesn't know who White Zombie are, they were fairly prevalent at this point in time, right?
I would assume so. Yeah. I'm not kind of a fan of that style of music, really, but yeah. In the ring, the Headbangers hit a terrible double clothesline to Henry, with something off-screen getting a bigger reaction than anything in the ring.
What was it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I couldn't break it out.
Dropped something.
Marlena.
Someone dropped something.
Was it Vince dropping the ball on this opening match?
Thrasher misses a pretty decent-looking moonsault, and both he and Henry make ice-cold tags. Phineas looks for the slop drop, but Thrasher blocks it, and Mosh knocks Phineas down clumsily. While Thrasher keeps Henry occupied, Mosh dives off the top rope with the stage dive for the three at 10:39. The crowd pops for the finish, but they may just be popping that the match is finished.
Yeah. How did you feel about this, boys?
Not great, to be honest.
Probably not the best choice for an opener.
Yeah, it had a lot more potential when those other two teams were in it, and to be left with two teams that no one really cares that much about, I think the Godwins have lost any momentum that they particularly had.
Well, we were talking the other day, it's a slot bucket. They've not got the... That's why they're over.
That has gone, yeah.
Yeah, the slot bucket's gone. The pigs have gone. They've still got Hillbilly Jim, but that's not working for them, really.
Yeah, that's not why they're over.
And I think that actually the competency of the match really plummets once Furnace and Lafon have gone.
Yeah.
These two, there's quite a few botches, sloppy moves, stumbles. It's not great.
The thing is, like, you just know in kind of Vince's mind, like, he's going to be way higher on hog farmers, cowboys and metalheads than he is wrestlers. So you almost feel sorry for Furnace and Lafon in the sense that Vince hasn't given them a gimmick. Because maybe if they actually had a stupid gimmick, Vince would let them go longer in matches and be more prevalent, and they'd get to do the cool stuff they get to do.
If they were like Furnace and Lafon, the carpenters.
Or
Furnace and Lafon, the grain inspectors.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, the bullshit elimination of the Blackjacks and Furnace and Lafon certainly didn't help the situation. And I kind of feel like this had been more suited to be like a piss break match later in the card.
Yeah, it's nothing that you kind of want a nice hot opening to a show to warm people up. And this really didn't achieve that.
The Headbangers did pull off a couple of decent bits, but they also looked really bad on some really simple stuff.
Yeah.
And the Godwins are the Godwins.
To be fair, the Headbangers simply don't deserve a title shot in no way, shape or form.
And they're probably quite restricted by wearing them skirts.
Yeah.
Well, do you not that gives them a bit more freedom?
Well, it's freedom in another
sense. Unless you're being held upside down.
In which case you probably want to be more smashed down.
After a very obvious cut on the DVD that houses an In Your House advert on the network, the Honky Tonk Man is in the ring. Maybe he'll disappear again like he did the other month.
Hopefully.
He dances quite close to a couple of Vince's God signs.
There is a few Vince signs in the crowd here.
Yeah.
But one later on that Vince's God and Bischoff's his bitch. Yeah.
Lou Albano and Arnold Skoland are in the crowd. Lou has a bit of a dance.
Nice.
Lawler beckons Honky to join the announce team, with JR offering, "You guys are pretty close. Anyone would think you were cousins or something." Also removed here, apparently, is a segment with Brian Pillman and Sonny hyping the superstar line, which I'm sad we didn't get to see. She isn't featured on this show at all.
No, she doesn't appear. And
neither does Sable. Thanks.
Honky singing here, I thought, was a lot better than when we saw it on Shotgun Saturday Night. Maybe he's not drunk here.
Possibly. Up next is our WWF Intercontinental title match. It's Rocky Maivia versus the Sultan. This feud has its roots in one of the more bizarre angles in WWF history. It all began a year ago when the Sultan, who wasn't even on the roster at the time, ran over the ringmaster in his car. No, wait, that's not it. Being as the Sultan has done pretty much next to nothing since debuting last August, it can certainly be considered totally out of left field that he's challenging for the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania, especially as he's had precisely zero matches on pay-per-view, excluding his appearance in the Royal Rumble itself in January. Plans at the time seemed to suggest that it was scheduled to be Mark Mero challenging Rocky for the Intercontinental title here, following a heel turn for the Wild Man, which seems to make sense given their conflict over Sable on Shotgun Saturday Night back on January 11th, and the direction of their characters prior to Mero's knee injury in February. Whether that match would have been for the Intercontinental title had Hunter Hearst Helmsley not been left to pick up the title change slack after Sean's fake knee injury around the same time is debatable. Attempting to set up the contest on the March 10th Raw is War, as we saw, the Sultan and his entourage would watch Rocky win a squash match from the stage while Bob Backlund screamed through the microphone. Following Rocky's victory, the Sultan would charge the ring but would be easily fended off by the Intercontinental champion, who also clocked Backlund and Sultan's trainer, the Iron Sheik. Backing up the ramp, Rocky would spot his father's former tag team partner, Tony Atlas, in the crowd and back up the aisle with Atlas in tow. The following week, on March 17th, Rocky would kind of provide commentary on a Sultan squash match. After his grueling 30-second win, the Sultan would stare down Rocky, with Tony Atlas once again appearing from the audience to provide Maivia with backup. In spite of this epic two-week feud, this bout can easily be considered the lowest-profile Intercontinental title match to date in the history of WrestleMania, although sadly enough, the promotion's secondary title belt will plumb even lower depths in the future.
Well, I was kind of looking forward to seeing this.
But when you kind of consider the IC title matches we've seen at Mania before, so
Shawn Razor
and Razor Jarrett, because we didn't get one at WrestleMania 12 because Goldust faced Piper. It's a downward tangent. And then when you include ones before our timeline, Bret Hart, Roddy Piper at 8, Macho Man, Steamboat at 3, Warrior Rick Rude at 5, it's a lot lower profile than it's ever had.
The Sultan, yes.
Well, the thing is, like, I quite like, the, you know, Rikishi. Let's call him for namesake.
D'Lo Brown.
Let's not, because that's who I thought it may have been, but it turns out it's not. Who knew? Yeah, I quite like him, so I thought I'll give this match the benefit of the doubt to start off with.
I like his entrance. It kind of, you know, got smoke and music and Bob Backlund. It's
and I
right.
like his shoes.
His shoes are good. His mask's quite cool.
Out to absolutely zero reaction is the Sultan, alongside Iron Sheik and Bob Backlund. We get another Vince's God sign, this time with an added Bischoff is his bitch. Sheik for Prez is also visible.
That would be awesome.
What?
Iron Sheik for President.
Oh, thought,
you say yeah. Sheep.
No, I thought you said Sheik.
I did. Sheik
like but as in something that is Sheik.
Right.
Rather than the Sheik.
Lawler urges Honky not to consider Rocky for the honour of being his protégé. The Sultan seems to have inherited a version of Adam Bomb's mushroom pyro.
It's not quite as mushroomy, though, is it?
Not quite as good, but it's a little bit version of it. Mm. The Intercontinental Champion, Rocky Maivia, is out next to very little reaction. When he makes it to the ring, he stands right in front of a sign which reads, "Die, Rocky, die."
On a slightly side tangent, have you seen that Rock has been tweeting pictures of him and David Hasselhoff on the set of filming for the new Baywatch movie?
No.
Apparently that's actually happening.
So is the Rock in the like the Hulk Hogan mode where he's going to be on jet skis and...
No, I think it's going to be done higher budget than that. I think it's going to be...
More like Thunder in Paradise.
If only.
I don't know. I'm not sure whether they're going to like resurrect characters.
Right.
And just give them different actors to play them. But it just seems strange that the Hasselhoff might be in it as well.
Are any of the women from the original series going to be in it?
Not that I'm aware of. I've not done depths of research on this, surprisingly.
You just went and watched Old Baywatch afterwards, right?
I've not watched any Old Baywatch in a while. I do have them all downloaded.
He was telling me about, was it Erica Eleniak's eyebrows?
Yeah, crazy eyebrows. Really gorgeous, kind of like model-esque features, but crazy eyebrows.
Well, has that put you off dating her?
No. She sorted them out now. They're only a bit strange in the late 80s.
The Sheik waves his Iranian flag to try and get this bout a bit of heat. Tony Atlas is once again in the crowd, and Lawler tells him off for chewing gum on television.
Well, I put, because they talk about the old tag team.
Yeah.
So I put, why is Tony Atlas here rather than Rocky's dad?
Good question.
Yeah, good question, I think.
There's consistency, though, because Atlas has been there in the massive build-up to this.
But it's almost like he's stalking him.
That would be an odd storyline.
What would be even odder is if they've shown Tony Atlas and he's been in the build-up, but he's not used at all in any point of this match.
That would be weird. So it's like, it's been used twice on TV in the as you say, in the massive build-up to this.
And then he's just been shown to be there.
So we can assume that at some point he'll run out and do something, some shenanigans?
Yeah, probably.
I've got the real reason he's there. He's got like a foot fetish, hasn't he? He wants the Sultan's shoes. It's nothing to do with Rocky at all. That's just coincidental. Rocky makes some sort of weird finger gesture before we get a shoving match. It ends with the Sultan shoulder block.
Oh, is that the thing? Well, I think he was trying to get the crowd into it.
It didn't work.
But it was...
It's more like a beckoning.
Yeah, but with two fingers.
Okay, I misunderstood it then.
I think that was it.
Yeah. Well, what did you think it was?
Thought it was weird.
Well, it was a bit weird, but I think he was trying to get the crowd on side, and the crowd didn't do anything, so the Sultan hit him.
Rocky kips up, and we get a clothesline coming out of the corner and a pair of drop kicks, with the second sending the Sultan to the outside.
I don't like the Rock's drop kicks. I don't think they've got any sort of impact. It's not like an Owen Hart drop kick or something like that. It's a bit sloppy. No, he takes them out of his arsenal, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Relatively shortly.
Sultan consults with Bob Backlund while he's there. Small Rocky sucks chants pick up.
He's doing well, this kid.
Sultan drags Rocky to the outside and another fist fight erupts. Rocky goes to clothesline Sultan, but Sultan ducks and Rocky whacks the ring post. Sultan rams Rocky's head into the steel barricade and Sultan rolls Rocky back into the ring and focuses his attack on Rocky's shoulder before kicking him just above the nads. Rocky fights back with fists, but Sultan blocks and tosses Rocky into the corner, hitting a clothesline on the rebound, which gets a two. The Sultan applies a Vulcan nerve hold as slightly more audible Rocky sucks chants start up again.
Vulcan nerve hold, is that basically when he was working the trapezius area?
Correct.
Vince was calling it.
Rocky fights back to his feet and ducks a clothesline, but gets a knee to the stomach. Sultan hits a backbreaker and heads to the top rope to hit a knee drop, which gets a small pop. People are popping for the Sultan.
Yes.
Not the babyface.
No.
That's not good.
Well, it is for the Sultan.
Yes, it is good for the Sultan. It's Bob Backlund. That's what
probably.
It is.
I'd cheer Bob Backlund. Sultan posing does get some boos, though. A lackadaisical cover gets a two. Rocky looks for a sunset flip, but Sultan grabs Rocky by the throat, lifting him to his feet and hits a belly-to-belly suplex for another two.
I thought that was a nice little section, but I did notice it did take the Rock to kind of do a little bit of scurrying on his feet to help getting from underneath the Sultan.
Yeah. Sultan's strong, but Rock's probably a bit too big to be lifting up by the head.
JR gets narky about Sultan's pinning tactics. It's chin lock time because this match has been so full pelt. It does give us time, however, for a Lawler line which tops his earlier one.
Is this the Christopher Reeve one?
Yeah.
Talking about Rocky's acceptance speech at the Slammies, he claims it was so boring that Christopher Reeve got up and walked out.
Wow.
I thought that was in terribly poor taste.
Did you really?
Presumably he'd had his horse riding accident.
Yeah. I think it was, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he fell off, yeah.
Rocky has a nap, so El Hebner lifts his arm, which he keeps up on the third time, which gets big boos.
But the thing is, they've got that spot, and the camera doesn't even catch the big bit with the third hand.
Mm.
Well, not as he's got three hands, but like when he's, yeah.
with his third hand.
Yeah.
Rocky gets to his feet and breaks the hold, leading to a double clothesline so they can have another rest. Rocky eventually rolls over for a two count. Both men make it to their feet, and for some reason, Rocky does Tatanka's dance.
Mm. Yeah, he's
Native Americaning up.
Yeah.
Rocky takes Sultan down with punches and a dropkick, followed by a belly-to-belly of his own for a two.
I thought that was actually okay.
Rocky hits his float over DDT and mouths, "That's for my fucking dad," before heading to the top rope.
Did he?
Yes, he does.
I was probably writing down his DDT. And it's the, there was a comment right on his leather face. Wasn't the form of the cock? Yes. Probably King.
You've got Honky commenting on this all the way through. Did anyone else think he sounded really angry?
I think it's just really annoying. I don't get why he's there.
Yeah, he just sounds really pissed off.
He's looking
all the
for
time.
His protege.
Yeah, but nobody wants him to have a protege.
If this were now, they could do it as like an X Factor style show on the WWE Network.
Mm.
Yes.
America's Next Top Honky Tonk Man.
Man. Yes.
A Honky Tonk Factor.
Yeah. I think you'd be in with a shout, Paul.
Honky Tonk Idol.
There you go. Well done.
Britain's Got Honky Tonk Man. I think we've done them all now.
Rocky hits a crossbody and covers, but Sheik is up on the apron, so Earl Hebner doesn't count. Rocky turns around before Sultan can attack, but walks into a Sultan superkick, which gets a two.
And a bit of a reaction. I quite liked it.
Sultan sets up for his devastating pile driver and hits it, getting another two.
Sorry. Good work.
Sorry, I know this is going back a moment in the conversation, but it's just been making me laugh in my head, so I've got to say it. And it's not even a talent show, but Anton Deck's Honky Tonk Man takeaway.
Yeah. That's not even a thing.
It's Anton Deck's Saturday Night takeaway. Do you watch it?
No, I've been told about it. Yeah.
I'm a Honky Tonk Man, get me out of here.
That works too.
Honky Tonk Man's house party.
Yes, at Crinkly Bottom. Deal or no Honky Tonk Man.
Now you're just naming shows. Yeah.
Emmerdale.
Anyway.
Sultan looks for a scoop slam, but Rocky slides over and schoolboy Sultan for the three at 9:45. Backlund and Sheik get into the ring with Rocky leaving to speak with JR. Before he can say anything, Sultan attacks from behind and whacks Rocky with his belt and rolls the IC champion back into the ring. Sultan heads to the top rope and splashes Rocky, very nice, before Sheik applies the camel clutch to make Rocky humble.
I love the fact that we've seen the Iron Sheik do a camel clutch on pay-per-view. It's brilliant.
Moment of the night for Adam. Sheik slaps Rocky in the face before Rocky Johnson slides into the ring and does some dancing punches to the Sultan and the heel trio seemingly retreat. But wait, no. Sultan whacks Rocky Johnson with his flag and rips the elder Rocky's shirt off. Rocky Jr. fights back to his feet and disposes of the heels, with his slam of the Sheik getting the biggest reaction of the entire match. Rocky Sr. gives Sheik one for good measure too, and the heel trio retreat. Father and son embrace in the ring, as Vince tells us that nobody knew Rocky Johnson was here, and the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon.
Right, what I don't get is Tony Atlas is sat just two rows away. Well, they're both getting their heads kicked in. Why did he come out and
he
help?
He was probably sitting there thinking, oh, God, Rocky's getting kicked in. I best do something. Then Rocky Johnson comes out and he thinks, well, it's all right. But then when they both start getting their heads kicked in, maybe he should have come out then.
Yeah.
Well, it was obviously some elaborate bait and switch, which was the entire point of the whole thing, where we thought Tony was going to save Rocky.
Yeah.
But Swerve, big time Swerve, because nobody knew he was there, his dad actually saves him. That's pretty lame. Jose Lothario was pretty fucking lame, and he actually never saved Shawn Michaels as far as I can recall. Atlas actually only makes one more solitary appearance a couple of weeks after this, again, sitting in the crowd, and then nothing happens. Brilliant.
It's probably going to work to get Rocky over.
But I've got it. This is what they need to do at Mania to get Roman over. Have Seeker come out and body slam Triple H, and maybe the Iron Sheik too. It'll definitely work.
Should they really be slamming the Iron Sheik at this point?
I don't think he's as crippled as he is 3-4 years later at the Gimmick Battle Royal.
Does he take a bit of a downwards hill?
He must do, yeah, because that's the reason he wins it, because they can't throw him over the top, right? Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Then Sergeant Slaughter does him over with a Cobra Clutch.
Thoughts on the match?
Not great. Like, a bit meh.
There's a couple of nice little bits in there, but it's not an Intercontinental Championship match at WrestleMania.
Yeah. Again, Rikishi, the Sultan, whatever you want to call him, nice splash, nice super kick, nice pile driver. Actually pretty competent stuff. He didn't do his clothesline bump in this, though, did he?
No,
I was waiting out for that. But he's a competent performer. He made it look good. But it's just not working, is it? I don't think anyone cared about bringing in Tony Atlas or Rocky Johnson or anyone like that. It was a bit flat.
Plus, kind of omitted from my commentary on the match was how much the commentators just talked about Rocky's dad.
Yeah.
The entire match. So yeah. For some people, it then may have been obvious that Rocky's dad was going to come out and help him. But yeah, they just banged on about him loads. I wouldn't say it was terrible, but it wasn't good. It was just kind of there, and it definitely, like you say, didn't feel worthy of WrestleMania.
It's like a Raw match.
Yeah.
Not your biggest pay-per-view of the year match.
Like you say, it's a shame for the Sultan, Fatu, Rikishi, whatever you want to call him, in the sense that he's always been quite good when we've seen him, and even having put on this amount of weight since he was Fatu, he's still clearly capable of some impressive stuff for a guy his size, but he's just stuck with a shit gimmick.
Yes. An outdated gimmick.
And as far as Rocky goes, is it a case of, do you think they just rushed him up to TV?
Yeah, I think he just went up there too quickly. And even from appearing on TV to get to this stage, it's too quick to get to this stage. He's not earned it.
Yeah. And do you think that's where the backlash has come from?
I don't know where the backlash... I'm a little perplexed as why people hate him so much, because I think, give him a chance, but...
It's the Roman thing, isn't it? We've mentioned this before. You've got a similar thing going on now with the fact that Roman Reigns is very obviously being pushed as this is the person that we want you to like.
Yeah.
And I think you've got a version of that happening at this time. Like, Rocky is the person that we want you to like, and not everyone likes being told who they're going to like. You've also got the fact that he is quite a dull character. And we saw that with his Slammy speech, was just beige.
I hear Christopher Reeve walked out of it.
Shocking. Everyone was amazed. He's got no sort of fire or personality or anything. He's not really got a gimmick, has he, other than that he's a third-generation wrestler.
He's a blue chipper, man.
And where do you stand then on the familial thing in terms of, does that even help him, or does that just add further issues to him in the sense that it now looks like we're pushing him on the fact he's even hired is because of his dad?
It shouldn't be part of his on-screen character. Fair enough, if the fact that he is from a generation of wrestlers to help him into the business, to give him that push-up, fine. But it shouldn't be the overriding part of his character that's displayed to the TV, is that he comes from a wrestling family, so he must be dead good. Let's give him all his dad's moveset. And there we go. We've got a new version of Rocky Johnson, and that's what you're going to like. Oh, and he's got the IC title after being in for basically no time at all. Mm. And it's painfully obvious to everyone why he's got that. And perhaps that's where the backlash is coming from.
Oh, I think Rocky Dog Johnson should have been sat next to Helen and Stu Hart.
Should have been.
Possibly.
Helen Hart should have saved him. That would have been a swerve.
Yeah, Helen Hart runs out.
Yeah.
Batters the Sultan.
Stu Hart comes out with his Castrol GTX bomber jacket.
Where's Sid's mum and dad? I wonder what they're like.
Massive.
All right, Vince, thank you very much. Ken Shamrock, indeed, will be the guest referee. If Stone Cold Steve Austin or Bret the Hitman Hart get out of line, they both said they will not hesitate to come after you. What will be your response?
Well, I tell you, I was hired here to ref this match because I know submission. And neither one of these guys are going to intimidate me into either or one of their favor. I'm here as to be a referee, and that is what I will do. And I will raise the winner's hands, and I will not be intimidated.
Ken Shamrock, the special guest referee in that submission matchup. Let's now go to Doc Hendricks. Doc.
All right, Todd, standing here with Slammy Award-winning Hunter Hearst Helmsley. And Hunter, you know, we're still a little unsure of your relationship with China. I mean, is she a personal assistant? Is she an employee? Is she your boss? What is the deal?
Doc Hendricks, this is WrestleMania 13. We're in Chicago, Illinois. It's the granddaddy of them all. And as far as China goes, you don't need to know anything about it.
All right, be that as it may, what about right now? Goldust, we've seen China get involved, attack Marlena. Can you take Goldust one-on-one straight up?
I can take Goldust any way I want. Today I'm going to take him straight up, one-on-one. But the big loser is going to be Marlena, because you had the chance and you turned it down. So your special talent had better be running with China at ringside tonight, Marlena.
Todd Pettingill is stood by with Ken Shamrock in a lovely tracksuit. Ken cuts another tepid promo about how he's the referee and he won't be intimidated and he knows submission, so there.
I will not be intimidated.
It is zero charisma coming out from... What have you put?
No charisma.
No charisma. No charisma, Ken. That could have been his gimmick.
He gets a lot more personality when he just starts screaming.
He gets more personality when he's in the heat of the moment. That's where he's born, I think. In terms of his wrestling character.
Todd throws to Doc, who is stood by with someone's massive arm.
And an incredibly echoey mic.
Yeah, it sounds like they're in a cave.
When they're not.
The arm belongs to China. Triple H is also there. Doc asks Hunter about his relationship with China, asking if she's his boss. Triple H basically ignores it to cut a babyface promo about how they're in Chicago, Illinois. Hunter briefly addresses Goldust before saying Marlena's talented, better be running away with China nearby.
It's not as identifying cigars.
I did wonder about one of the lines he said.
Is it the same one that I've got written down?
I can take Goldust anywhere I want.
Yeah, I got that.
Sounds a bit...
Says he will take Goldust any way he wants.
Oh, I think anywhere, but still, I think either way, it's still sinister.
I think anyway is a bit more sinister than anywhere.
Okay.
A quick video package runs down the Slammy Awards. Obviously, we need to be showing that guy pissing himself, as it was such a highlight. We get Taker's Sinatra promo, Owen being the best, Triple H getting his hair slammy, and Mankind doing his Rocky bit. Oh, and we get the TNA exhibition while Pillman cuts his speech about it being a TNA exhibition.
Nice.
Up next is something that might be worthy of WrestleMania. Goldust versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley. A dispute which has roots stretching all the way back to Survivor Series the previous November.
Yeah, it does feel like this has been going on for a while.
Following comments that I don't think we ever discovered exactly what they were, Helmsley made to Marlena during the show's free-for-all and prior to the eight-man elimination match that Helmsley and Goldust would team up in, on the December 1st Superstars, Helmsley would defeat Goldust in an Intercontinental title match via countout after using Marlena's cigar on Goldust. The bizarre one would interject himself in Helmsley's title defence against Mark Merrow at In Your House It's Time on December the 15th, causing Helmsley to lose via countout to the Wild Man. Goldust would make his babyface turn the following night on December 16th, following the Milton Bradley Karate Fighters tournament final, after Helmsley's pal Jerry the King Lawler accused him of being a queer. Goldust and Helmsley's first big singles match would come at the Royal Rumble on January the 19th, with Helmsley debuting Mr. Hughes as his short-lived bodyguard. Helmsley would pick up the win to keep the issue going following a Hughes distraction. Goldust would gain a measure of revenge later in the evening, eliminating Helmsley from the Royal Rumble bout itself. Following another month of causing distraction during each other's matches, I'm not going to go through it all, at In Your House Final Four on February the 16th, Helmsley would face Rocky Maivia in a rematch for the Intercontinental title he had lost to Maivia 3 days earlier on Thursday, Raw Thursday. Goldust would cause the distraction to Helmsley, flapping his bottom at the Greenwich Blue Blood, allowing Maivia to get the pin with a back suplex. After the bout, Goldust's valet Marlena would be attacked from the crowd by a rather large woman who would be dragged away by security. On the February 17th Raw, Kevin Kelly would interview Goldust and Marlena, with Goldust saying that his feud with Helmsley was now personal, and Marlena assuring us that Goldust was more man than Helmsley would ever be. Helmsley would confront the duo and hit the pedigree on Goldust, with Marlena slapping Hunter in the face. That woman would then enter the ring and ragdoll Marlena before once again being removed by security. Goldust would return later in the evening to confront Helmsley, chasing Hunter from the ring during his match with Bart Gunn. On the March 10th debut episode of Raw is War, Hunter Hearst Helmsley would attack Goldust from behind after Goldust's match with Tim McNeady, with China providing a distraction from the ramp. Marlena would jump on the back of That Woman, garnering one of the biggest pops of the show. That Woman would finally be given a name on the March 17th Raw is War. Helmsley's valet would now be known as China. After a short career competing in fitness competitions, China, real name Joan Laura, or Laura, whatever you pronounce it as, would begin training with WWF Hall of Famer Walter Killer Kowalski in 1995, wrestling under the name Joni Lee, in matches against both women and men. After meeting Hunter Hearst Helmsley, who had also trained under Kowalski, and his pal Shawn Michaels in 1996, the duo would approach Vince McMahon about bringing her into the WWF. Although McMahon was initially reluctant to hire her, believing his audience would be sceptical about a woman beating up men, Laura would sign for the WWF after she was approached by WCW to be the sole female member of the NWO.
Okay. So it was, we'll get you before they do.
But was talked out of signing with the opposition by Vince's son Shane. Do take this with a grain of salt, however, as it comes from China's 2001 WWF-produced autobiography, which is widely considered to be a work of fiction.
Ah.
Laura's trainer, Kowalski, claims that he was the one who brought her to the attention of the WWF in his role as a talent scout for his former employers, though he does back up that WCW had interest in her after he had spoken with Kevin Nash about founding a role for her in Atlanta. China's version of the story also has slight historical inaccuracies in that she claimed that Shawn and Hunter wanted to bring her in as the bodyguard for D-Generation X, despite the fact that the group is several months away from being formed.
Mm.
Fun fact for Adam, allegedly she has a model of breast implant named after her, the China 2000s, which are marketed towards women with large builds and female bodybuilders.
The China 2000s?
Correct.
Is that named after the year that she had them, were they done in the year 2000?
Presumably. But just things sound better when you call something 2000.
It's like South Park Series 4, where all the titles were 2000, weren't they?
Yeah.
Tooth Fairy Tits 2000 and Timmy 2000.
You'll have to look them up, Adam. Just tell us about their model and their make and what support they provide.
I wonder what's in them. Maybe they need to be a bit more sort of hardy because they're put on top of so much muscle tissue. I don't know.
Interesting. Where does the name China come from? Is there any derivation?
I have no idea.
It's just like China.
Better than Joan.
It's better than Joan. It gets better later on when WCW hire like a female bodybuilder and decide to call her Asia because Asia is bigger than China.
Yeah.
That's genius. We won't go into details right now of her post-WWF career, but allegedly these days she lives in Japan teaching English to children.
Yeah.
Maybe you can ask her about it at WrestleCon, Adam.
Is she going to be there?
Yes.
No, I'm all right.
Well, maybe you can ask her why she was called China, because Paul would like to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that's a reasonable question, isn't it?
And then ask her about being the She-Hulk.
Or the 2000s.
Tell me about your China 2000s implants. Are they saline or silicone?
It should probably kick your head in.
Let's hope not, eh?
I'm getting the impression that basically nobody gets reactions coming out on this show as Hunter Hearst Helmsley and China make their way to the ring to yet another round of silence. Somebody has gone to the effort, though, of making a "When Hunter and China get silly, who got the willy?" sign.
I noticed that, yeah.
Grammatically incorrect as well. Did you spot that? It says, "When Hunter and China get silly, who got the willy?" Two different tenses.
Tenses, yeah, yeah. Tense shift, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Vince describes China as "that monstrous Amazonian."
Mm.
He really loves the word monstrous.
Well, they keep banging on about monstrous Amazonian. Like, that gets said about 50 times in the next minute and a half.
Next classic Lawler line, though. He thinks he's worked out what happened to China. When she was born, she was such an ugly baby, she was breastfed by her father.
See, I hate that's the sort of line that he does that I really hate.
Yeah, I thought you might.
But, see, it's that kind of, it's all chalk and cheese, really, isn't it? Because you get those nice, like,
Fleetwood Mac
lines, and unlike the Mount Rushmore line, and then you get this. which is in a different category.
Goldust actually gets a bit of a pop when he enters alongside Marlena, but they're probably popping for her.
Definitely for Marlena.
He also gets a modicum of pyro. Marlena has changed her hair. I wonder how Adam feels about this.
It's got less volume. It's less of a mullet now. It's more just standard long hair. I don't feel great about it.
You had a little cry.
But her outfit makes up for it.
JR says he spoke to Goldust earlier in the day, and he's concerned about Marlena's welfare at ringside. Then why bring her to the ring?
Yeah, probably leave her home.
Mm. Goldust squats and stares at Hunter.
Yeah, that was very strange. It very much is squatting.
Maybe, like, there's a subtext to it. I'm going to shit on you.
Well, that's it. He looks like he's taking a shit.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. He explodes out of it, though, to clothesline Hunter and pound away on his face. I thought it was quite an explosive
good,
start.
Yeah. Good opening, yeah.
As it should be. He gets his drop-down punch and mounts Helmsley in the corner for 10 punches that the crowd counts along with him. Goldust takes the time to spit at China and kiss Hunter before he finishes the 10 punches.
Good work, Goldust. Well done.
Goldust gets an atomic drop and clotheslines Hunter to the outside before doing one of his heel poses for a pop. Okay, maybe he's kind of getting over as a face?
I think so.
Goldust wraps Hunter's arm around the top rope on the apron, slides to the outside, and then hits Hunter in the face when he gets there. I really like that.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of, for me, it's a more elaborate version of his drop-down punch.
Yeah, exactly.
Effectively.
Yeah.
But I really like this kind of 30 seconds or so. I thought was really brilliantly worked out and I think very well planned with how they've gone through that. He then drops down into the kind of Andre the Giant trapped in the ropes for a bit of a beat down. But then he gets a kick out of it, doesn't he? So Goldust kicks him and that gets him out of the tie in the ropes to end that little sequence very nicely. I thought that was like a really well thought out bit of wrestling.
Also, the punch that he does when he's tied up in the ropes is like square in the face.
Yeah.
It's what Lawler says, he hit him right in his nose.
He also say proboscis at some point, or Vince will at some point.
Mm. Well, Lawler also claims that Helmsley makes Pinocchio look like a cat.
He said that before, hasn't he?
Yeah, but what?
Cats don't really have a nose.
I know.
That sticks
well, they
out,
do,
but it's flat, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cats don't have a nose. You heard it here first, folks.
Goldust clotheslines Hunter back into the ring and looks for a back body drop, but Helmsley gets his knee to Goldust's face. Goldust fights back quickly with a snap power slam and heads to the top rope, but Hunter cuts him off and heads to the top himself. Helmsley looks for a superplex, but Goldust blocks it. Instead, Hunter drops Goldust to the outside with the Bizarre One whacking his face on the apron on his journey to the floor.
Nice.
Hunter rolls Goldust back into the ring and hits a chop to the head from the top rope for a two count. Weird. It's a Tonka. Hunter undoes Goldust's top and hits chops to the chest before stomping away at Goldust in the corner. Helmsley taunting Marlena gets boos while China stands still.
She actually doesn't move a millimetre for most of this match.
She looks like she's in a natural trance.
Yeah.
Lawler on China part two. I think they filmed Gorillas in the Mist in China's shower.
I don't even think that makes any sense. Why? Well, you know, get the camera wet.
Helmsley hits a neck breaker for a two, pointing at Marlena while he makes the cover. Hunter applies an abdominal stretch to kill any heat they'd build up. And while the camera focuses on Marlena and her massive cigar at ringside.
There are some protracted rest holds this evening.
Hunter goes for extra leverage, but the referee sees it, kicks Hunter's hand away, and Goldust hip-tosses Hunter out of it.
When they first started this, I almost thought we were going to see an abdominal stretch with no leverage because he was too far away from the ropes.
But he just shuffles.
But he kind of shuffles along and grabs them anyway.
Hunter gets his high knee for a two and applies another rest hold on the mat before making a series of covers, attempting to hold Goldust's shoulders on the mat. Goldust counters with knees to the balls, but Hunter retains the advantage with a suplex. A knee drop for another two. Goldust fights back with punches in the corner, but Helmsley hits a DDT.
That was a bit where I really felt that this match might start to come alive.
Yeah.
Because there's a real sudden burst of energy from Goldust, and then the DDT kills it.
Plus, Triple H has got gold all over his face.
Yes.
But it's all around his mouth.
Yeah.
Like he's been kissing Goldust.
Well, Goldust did kiss him. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like gold paint, but to rub it on someone's face is demented. Yeah.
You got it on my face, you got it on the valance.
The what?
The skirt thing around the side of the bed.
Goldust gets a backslide for a two count, followed by a small package for another one, before he walks straight into a Helmsley clothesline. Hunter falls on a Goldust scoop slam, attempt for a two. Goldust with a crossbody for a two. They collide heads mid-ring and both men go down. Helmsley heads to the top rope, but dives into Goldust's bottom.
A keister clobber.
Yeah, well...
Which I've spelled with a K because it felt that kind of move.
Keister, clobber.
Yeah.
Clobber with a K.
Yeah, both.
Okay.
But he dived into his bottom.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was some quite innovative attack by Goldust.
Using his butt. He does do that. It's called the thump in the games, wasn't it? If you give someone a thump, they did the butt first attack. Asuka does it, doesn't she?
Naomi does butt attacks as well.
Yeah. Understandable.
JR claims that kids will have nightmares about China.
It's not very nice.
Goldust moves on a Helmsley charge in the corner and hits right hands in a back body drop. Helmsley does his flair tribute act in the corner and walks into a Goldust bulldog, which gets a two. China makes a move towards Marlena as Goldust looks for the curtain call, but Helmsley flips out of it. Hunter sets up for the pedigree, but Goldust slingshots Hunter over the top rope. Goldust looks for the curtain call again, but spots China confronting Marlena, so he lifts his director up on the apron. Helmsley, though, charges and knees Goldust in the back, knocking little Marlena into China's arms. China then does her best to break Marlena's neck, ragdolling her around as Helmsley hits the pedigree for the three and the win at 14:28. Lawler claims Marlena jumped to attack China as Helmsley and China celebrate in the ring, standing over Goldust while Marlena rolls around on the mat in agony. Goldust cradles his wife before we see a replay of the finish.
That was a brilliant finish, I thought. And the term ragdoll, I think, doesn't do it justice. Like, I think all credit to both of the women there, because I think Marlena must do a very good job of pretty much going completely limp to enable, because she really just flailing all over the place.
She must only weigh about 7 stone, though.
But I don't care. I think they do a really good job of that. Looks so striking.
Yeah, but do you not think she's probably actually in danger of hurting her?
Super savage, but quite dangerous looking.
Possibly.
And she rolls around and gets covered up by Goldust, because I think that actually the severity of the bear hug probably shook her loose of her top. It's just a theory, but that's what I'm going with.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you see, there's no front to a top, is there? It's basically, it's like a waistcoat, but instead of having buttons, it's just glued with a six-inch gap going up the middle.
I didn't notice, no.
I did.
Adam pays attention to different things than you do.
Yeah. Mm. So she must have been stuck in there.
Okay.
And being thrown around like that might have shaken some things loose.
Because I put good characterisation, because I thought they were really good at selling the brutality of the attack, and Goldust looking very concerned.
It was, but I think there's a secondary motive as well.
Did you notice the laser pointer?
No. There's always laser pointers
going
on. It was
really annoying. But it kind of, when it goes back to show the replay, because there's a laser pointer that I noticed after, but when they show the replay, when Marlene is just on the apron, someone's just got a laser pointer on her crotch.
Okay.
It's just, don't. Silly.
At least you wouldn't blind her like that, because that's the danger with laser pointers.
It's like, why do people do, like, there's that thing where lots of people are shining at planes, like idiots.
I don't know, Paul.
There was a plane flying over Leicester yesterday, town centre, with a banner on the back of it that said, "Sorry, Diana, X." If anyone knows what that's about or who Diana is, do tell me, because I'm curious.
Lady Diana?
I don't think so.
Thoughts on the match?
I thought it was all right. It was a bit slow-paced a lot of times in it. I think the focus of the camera work was a bit too heavily leaned on looking at China and looking at Marlena rather than some stuff that was going on in the ring that was probably a bit more interesting. So the storyline build-up was a bit more important than the match, maybe. The end was good, if slightly overly choreographed.
I thought the... As I say, there was that sequence with the ropes and the drop down, kind of slide through the ropes and punch and stuff. Oh, I thought that was brilliant. I thought the ending was fantastic, actually. I thought the ending was really very attention-grabbing and very well done by all concerned. Probably, I think it's the best match that we've seen Goldust in. It wasn't a cracker. It was okay, but in terms of wrestling, I thought it was his best performance.
Exactly what I've got written down is probably the best we've seen Goldust look.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because I'll be honest, you know, I've not said lots of nice things about his wrestling since he's been... on the WWE or WWF portion of the show, but I thought it was his best showing.
And we have pointed that out every time we've seen him. I think in like either one of us or all of us have thought that Goldust should be doing better. We know that he can do better from watching Dustin Rhodes wrestle. Yet he just it's never seemed to have clicked with him.
Yeah,
yeah, but yeah, this probably was the best thing that we've seen him do.
Well, I've got it down as a match of two halves. Way better than their Royal Rumble match, but the only time it was heated was when Goldust was on offense, as he seemed determined to make it a heated, personal, frantic kind of fight. But Helmsley was happy to wrestle a sort of normal, slow-paced type of match, which meant, to me, it appeared like Goldust was over, but Helmsley wasn't.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, sterling effort by Goldust, but I don't know if just Hunter was kind of along for the ride with it or not.
Yeah, possibly Hunter's heart isn't in it as much. It's probably... more of a drop down for Hunter from where he could potentially be at the minute in the company.
Yeah. I also, like you, Paul, did really like the finish, but I felt sorry for Marlena having to get tossed around like that.
Are you both looking at me like I'm going to say something to that?
I thought you were just going to crack up. That's what I did instead.
Yeah. Pure oil.
I know.
Backstage, Shawn Michaels is on AOL and has trouble with the concept of a keyboard.
I did quite like this.
This is the thing that's on the network version, but not the DVD version, which is why I told Adam to watch the network version.
It makes him look like a right bell end.
My note here as well is that's legitimately how Adam types.
Compared to you, it is, but you're like a bit of a keyboard wizard.
Yeah, what was this all about?
It really just makes him look like a complete nutter.
I like the laptop, because it's a proper 1997 laptop that's about 8 inches thick.
Up next... is Owen Hart and the British Bulldog versus the tag team of Mankind and Vader for the WWF Tag Team title match.
Good-looking team.
Winning the Slammy Award for second most random match on this show is this contest for the tag team titles. Champions since September 1996, Davey Boy Smith and Owen Hart have been embroiled in a long-running, simmering tension storyline that seems to be poised to turn Davey Boy Smith babyface. The team have so far survived Owen eliminating Davey Boy from the Royal Rumble match on January the 19th, losing the Superstars Bowl on January 26th, various instances of miscommunication, Owen's various attempts at faking knee injuries to get out of matches, and the challenge of Doug Furness and Philip Lafonda in Your House Final Four on February 16th. On the February 17th Raw, Owen would pick up a win in singles action against Flash Funk after Davey Boy Smith appeared mid-match to order Clarence Mason to the back. Smith would clock Funk with Owen's slammy and hold Funk's foot down a la Rick Rude the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 5.
Hooray.
On the February 22nd episode of Shotgun Saturday Night, the British Bulldog would finally clear up the messy situation of Clarence Mason managing both the tag team champions as well as the Nation of Domination, who had also made inroads into the tag team ranks. Bulldog would square off with Crush, with announcers Jim Ross and Jim Cornette discussing that Mason had agreed to stay in the back for the contest due to a potential conflict of interest, as well as arranging for the Nation and Owen Hart to do the same. It wouldn't take long for the NOD and Owen to appear, however, with Crush picking up the win over Davey after Savio held down Bulldog's foot for the pin, pulling the same play that Owen and Davey had earlier in the week. After the match, Davey would fire Mason as his and Owen's manager, with the King of Hearts seemingly reluctant to go along with the decision. Would you like to do an impression of Davey Boy firing Clarence Mason?
You're fired.
You're bloody fired, bastard.
Something like that. Adding to their problems, the duo would end up facing off with each other in the finals of the European title tournament aired on the February 26th Raw, with Davey Boy becoming the first ever WWF European champion in a fantastic match that we covered towards the end of our Owen Heart of Gold episode late last year. On the March 15th episode of Shotgun, Davey Boy and Owen would be interviewed by Lance Wright, with Owen making snide comments that he could have beaten Davey Boy if he'd had tried his hardest, but that was in the past and they were now looking to the future. Davey Boy would rebuke Owen's claims, claiming that his win was fair and square, but would back up that they were focused on Mankind and Vader at WrestleMania. The duos would have their sole on-screen interaction for the match on the March 17th Raw is War, with the British Bulldog taking on Vader in a pretty good big man match that Davey would win via DQ when Mankind interfered. I guess you could count Owen tipping a waiter's worth of drinks down Vader at the Slammy Awards as billed for the feud, but that's more down to Owen's genius than the company's instructions. Owen and the Bulldog would cut one final promo hyping the match on the March 22nd Shotgun, with Owen insisting that he was the captain of their team and saying that the Bulldog needed to listen to him in their match at WrestleMania, and Bulldog claiming that he had been carrying Owen in the WWF for some time. The Wrestling Observer at the time suggests that the original plan for this show was a tag team title match pitting Owen and Davey against Doug Furness and Philip Lafon, with the challengers taking the straps, but that may have been scrapped due to the lukewarm response to Furness and Lafon since their debut in November. Thus, the challengers were changed to Mankind and Vader, whose sole bout as a tag team in 1997 was their contest against Sid and The Undertaker on the March 10th Raw is War, although they have been associated on television since Vader came under the guidance of Paul Bearer in January. In his first book, Have a Nice Day, Mick Foley says that the original plan for his Mania match was about with Mark Merrow. Apparently everyone was supposed to face Mark Merrow on this show. With Sable in Mankind's corner because of reasons. But
what?
Yeah, that's what Foley reckons anyway. But Foley made his displeasure with that scenario known. He also seems to have a major problem with Mark Merrow earning more money than him.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Right. Was he on a higher salary then?
Apparently, yeah. Wow. And he goes up to Mark Merrow and says, well, you may hear some rumours that I've said I don't want to work with you at WrestleMania. It's nothing personal. How can that be anything but personal?
Mm. Yeah.
Like, I don't want to work with you. I think you're shit. And I hate the fact you earn more money than me. Foley instead proposed a bout with Vader, which Vince apparently liked the sound of, but was keen to create a history for the duo that solely wasn't based on their past in another company. Thus, the plan to make them a tag team was formed, with plans for the duo to eventually feud, which, spoiler, does never really happen. At the very least, it brings us Paul Scriven's long-awaited all-heel tag team title match at WrestleMania, so it has that going for it.
I did actually book this match.
Vader, Mankind and Paul Bearer enter to Vader's theme. Bearer must have picked the urn up when Mankind threw it away, as he has it now.
Yep.
Bearer looks especially smug as he walks out.
He does.
Like, extra smug more than he normally does. The British Bulldog and Owen Hart enter to Davey's theme to a small pop, as Vince makes JR leg it up the aisle to speak with them. Where was Doc Hendricks? What was he doing? I'm not seeing Doc Hendricks, yeah. But
still in
Todd.
He's still in that cave.
Mm.
Are you offended when Owen Hart said he was smarter than you and that he was the captain of the team? I tried to stir him up. Listen, you're a cowboy wannabe. You leave Bulldog alone. He's got two belts.
Well, you said it
on television.
We're the champions. We're going to stay the champions. I've got two belts. He's got two slammies. Quit trying to stir it.
Well, who's the leader of the team?
I'm the leader. Leave us alone.
JR asks Bulldog about being offended that Owen claimed he was smarter than him. Both men rebuff JR, with Owen making sure to let JR know he's the captain of the team before they leave. Owen carefully places his slammy on the ring steps.
It's two slammies.
Owen and Vader start, with Vader posing to booze. Vader backs Owen into the corner and hits punches, taking Owen down. Owen slides through Vader's legs on an avalanche attack attempt, but can't take Vader down with a clothesline. A spinning heel kick does the job, but Owen then dives into Vader's chest with Vader hitting a slam.
Yeah, it's a good catch. You know, I'm always up for like a big man catch.
Owen avoids a Vader elbow, but Vader counters a Hurricanrana attempt with a powerbomb.
Pretty snug.
Vader sets Owen up for the Vader bomb, but Davey Boy blocks it. Mankind legs it into the ring and drags Bulldog in. Vader and Mankind look for a double clothesline, but Bulldog hits one of his own, followed by Owen hitting a dropkick. We reset with Bulldog and Mankind. Bulldog hits his big vertical suplex and Vader enters looking for a suplex of his own, but Davey counters and suplexes Vader for a pop.
Nice. Oh,
yeah, I mean, we've seen it before on the show. Was it...
The Raw is War match.
Yeah, I mean, that's... He shouldn't be able to do that to a guy like Vader. There can't be that many people much trickier than him to suplex.
Yokozuna.
Loch Ness.
But not many. I didn't say none. Thanks, boys.
Bulldog chinlocks Mankind as an Owen chant breaks out. And on the DVD, we get some brilliant dubbed over JR commentary where there's a long gap. Then JR just says, "Boy, I'll tell you, this has been a tremendous WrestleMania." Followed by another long silence. Superstar line, I presume.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Bulldog falls to the outside when Vader pulls the top rope down. Mankind looks to attack Davey Boy with the urn, but Bulldog drop toe holds Mankind. Have we ever seen the British Bulldog do a drop toe hold?
I don't know.
Vader's urn-based attack is more successful, and Paul Bearer looks delighted.
That is amazing.
Bulldog rolls back into the ring, where Vader hits a big suplex for a two.
Returning the favour.
Vader punches away at Bulldog in the corner and hits an avalanche attack in the opposite one. Vader splashes Bulldog from the second rope for a two. Vader tags Mankind, and Mankind hits his running knees in the corner and leg drops Davey Boy's head over the bottom rope from the apron. Mankind hits a back body drop at a weird angle and tags Vader. Another avalanche attack from Vader, and he heads to the second rope where Bulldog catches him and slams him when he dives.
Oh, he dives off into the slam. That was good. The timing that Jan must have to do on moves like that must be pretty impeccable.
Davey makes the tag to Owen, who drop kicks Vader from the top rope.
And I think King says, give him another slammy.
Best drop kick from the top rope.
Yeah.
Yeah, easily. Captain of the team slammy as well. Owen looks for a sunset flip and evades Vader sitting on his face, which was probably a good job.
Yeah.
Owen hits a crossbody from the top rope for a two, but runs full pelt into Vader's chest, cutting off his hot tag. Yeah. Vader tags Mankind, and while Bulldog is tied with the referee, they double-team Owen on the outside, with Mankind hitting an elbow to the floor while Owen is held over Vader's knee.
Yeah, that was nice. Although, to be fair, I think it perhaps looks better when the person's just on the floor. It's one of these instances where I think actually having it as a tag move perhaps detracts a little.
Is this the point where they mentioned that Owen's parents are in the audience?
It's slightly... Yeah, it is actually, yeah.
Yeah, it comes up around now.
And King is just delighted.
Yeah, he's so excited that Helen Hart's
He's
there.
Never more happy than when Helen Hart's
yeah,
there.
So he loves it.
The thing is, like, I'm sure he probably knew, but it's like he did a really good job of pretending that he didn't know they were there.
Mankind and Owen look to suplex each other either in or out of the ring, but Mankind drops Owen neck first over the top rope. Mankind chokes Owen on the floor right in front of his parents, who actually don't look that bothered. Helping Lawler's point about how they don't like Owen. Lawler asks if Stu even knows where he is.
I'll be fair, they do look a little bit kind of, you know, trance-like.
Quite often Stu does look like he doesn't know where he is, but there is one moment where the camera sort of cuts to him and he does that little shocked face where he's like, to the camera.
That helps, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the funniest thing we've seen Stu Hart do on the podcast.
I'll have to put out like that as a JPEG attachment with the podcast, Adam's Stu Hart shocked face.
Yes, you shall.
Back in the ring, Mankind looks for a neck breaker, but Owen reverses it into a DDT. Owen looks for a splash, but Mankind gets his knees up and covers for a two. Mankind whips Owen into the corner and they collide heads when Mankind charges. Owen hits a back kick for a two, and Mankind tags Vader, who smacks away at Owen.
He does do some very stiff punches in this match.
Owen slides out of a Vader suplex attempt and kicks Vader, but can't capitalise on it, and Vader elbows him in the back and covers for a two. Vader tags Mankind, who throws Owen to the outside immediately. Mankind charges Owen, but Owen hits a belly-to-belly suplex and crawls back into the ring.
I love the belly-to-belly.
Mankind follows and grabs Owen's foot, but Owen hits an enziguri and tags Davey Boy, who runs wild on Mankind and Vader.
Somewhere in this, Vader's mask disappears.
Yeah, I didn't see where. It was there 1 minute and gone the next.
Bulldog tosses Mankind face first into the corner, who takes a nasty-looking bump on it. Davey gets Mankind up for the running power slam, but Mankind applies the mandible claw as Owen and Vader face off.
That gets a big plop, the claw does.
Somehow Vader bumps Owen into Bulldog and Mankind, who fall to the outside with Mankind still applying the hold. The referee counts to 10 and we get a double count out at 16:08. Post-match, Mankind keeps the claw applied until Vader drags him off by the hair. Owen checks on Davey after their opponents leave, and Mankind and Vader have a nice hug in the aisle.
Mm. And Vader does that whistle.
What whistle?
He can do, you know, the really loud whistle, but without you.
Oh, yeah, that one that sounds like it's a member of the crowd, but it's actually him.
Yeah, that's the one. I kind of thought that it looked a bit sloppy almost, or messy when they fell out of the ring. But then when you realise that Foley keeps the hold on him throughout, it's kind of cool.
That said, I think overall the ending was a bit of a disappointment. I'd have preferred something decisive.
It's a real shame that it's just a bullshit finish.
Yeah, I think a bit of a disappointment all told, really. Given the talent of those in the match, it could have been much better. But the thrown together nature of the challenges and the whole affair made it a bit tepid, which is a shame. And yeah, the finish was also terrible. It doesn't feel like the sort of thing you'd want as the conclusion to a title match at WrestleMania.
No.
I've put damp squib.
Maybe like the month before, if you were building to a match at WrestleMania.
Yeah, this would be the finish that you'd have.
Yeah, to set up another match the next month where
you have a better finish.
You have a better finish, but again, spoilers, that doesn't happen. Mankind and Vader don't go forward as a team. And I know we'll have discussed the changes to the card kind of ad nauseum over the last couple of months, but I think Owen Bulldog versus Furnas LaFon and Mankind versus Vader could have been better uses of all six names than what they ended up doing.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, in all fairness, I actually quite liked the match. I didn't mind it. It had more potential than what it gave, but I think everyone put in a decent performance. They kind of did what they should have done. Mankind was nice and mental. Vader was big and stiff. Bulldog was strong and Owen was kind of weaselly. It was really, you know, it kind of did the business. It just suffered massively from a zero build-up, and if you'd have had more interest in the match, then the crowd involvement would have been more, which would have lifted the tone of the match. But I don't think it was bad.
I think it's along the lines of what Stuart hinted at. It's the weight of expectation, because you've got four guys that you know can do better than this.
Mm.
That's the big problem, and the ending.
Is the weight of expectation in any way similar to the burden of insight?
Very similar.
Okay.
It's terrible if you've got both.
Imagine, for over a decade, you fought to reach the pinnacle of your profession. Through sweat and dedication, you've earned the respect of fans, friends, and even your adversaries. Then, you walk away. When you return 6 months later, nothing is the same.
I've been screwed by Shawn Michaels, the boy toy. I've been screwed by Stone Cold Steve Austin. I've been screwed by the World Wrestling Federation.
There are no friends.
There's kind of a new motto in the World Wrestling Federation. You scratch my back and I'll stab yours.
There is no respect.
Everybody in that dressing room knows that I'm the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be.
Even your fans have changed. At the heart of this change is a man who spits in the face of your every accomplishment.
Ever since you came back, you ain't done nothing but cry.
He has gained fame by attacking you physically and verbally.
Steve Austin absolutely becomes obsessed with Bret Hart. Steve Austin is a rabbit. He's a rabbit animal.
This man mocks your legacy. He uses it as a stepping stone. Like a false prophet, he spews forth his rhetoric.
Bret Hart on his best day can't lace my boots, and I'm gonna prove that to the world. And I will beat the hell out of Bret, and that's the bottom line.
His followers carry placards singing his praise. Injustice after injustice has finally caused you to snap.
Whoa! Frustrated isn't a word for it. This is
now. The finger is pointed at you. You're the one who's changed.
He snapped, McMahon! He's lost it! Get him out of here! Drag him out!
Just hit on my finger, Pat Patterson! That dirty, rotten son of a...
They say your ego is your enemy. What happened to you? There's only one solution. To awaken from this nightmare, you must defeat him. To regain your life and resume your legacy, you must make him beg for mercy as you squeeze the will from his bones. But what if Stone Cold Steve Austin wins? What becomes of Bret the Hitman Hart then?
An excellent, excellent video package narrated by Todd Pettingill sums up Bret Hart's story since returning at Survivor Series 1996. It focuses on everything around him changing, but him then facing the accusations that he is the one who has changed. At the heart of this change, Stone Cold Steve Austin. We sum up with the idea that for Bret to carry on with his life and his legacy, he must defeat Austin. But what if Steve Austin wins? What becomes of Bret Hart then? Fantastic stuff.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I didn't understand what perspective it was from, because they keep narrating it like "you must" comes up a lot, and they change. Is perspective the right word? Like,
yeah, yeah.
The person, the narrative.
Yeah.
And so listening to it, it was very interesting, but I was also a bit confused.
I quite liked it.
Adam's got the burden of insight on that promo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't kind of notice that tense thing or perspective change, but yeah, I thought it was a really fantastic story that kind of, yeah, encapsulates Bret Hart's whole run since getting back at Survivor Series.
It's a shame that there's been no build-up to this, really.
thrown
together at the last minute. What I did like is when it gets to the ring, Ken Shamrock looks like he's got his shirt painted on.
Hang on, save that, because there's other stuff to talk about first.
I knew you were going to talk about other stuff, but I wanted to get in there before I forgot.
Up next is Bret the Hitman Hart versus Stone Cold Steve Austin in a submission match. They say that necessity is the mother of invention, and when Shawn Michaels tragically lost his smile in February and ran home to his mother, it was necessary for Vince McMahon to invent a new card for his biggest show of the year. Since Bret Hart's return in November, tension has been played up between the Hitman and the Heartbreak Kid, with both men making personal attacks towards one another on screen, despite being involved in feuds with Steve Austin and Sid respectively. The two would cross paths in a promo segment on the December 30th, 1996 episode of Raw, with Michaels calling Hart out on his claims of being a role model and Hart claiming that anyone who isn't a 14-year-old girl sees you for who you are towards Michaels. All of this seemed to build towards a rematch between the two, 1 year on from their Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12, with Bret Hart very much under the impression that Shawn would be returning the favour in dropping the WWF title to him when the time came. In his book, Bret claims that on February the 3rd, he called Vince to ask what the plans were for him at WrestleMania after Vince had asked him to put over Hunter Hearst Helmsley the previous evening at a house show in Montreal. Vince told Bret that his plans were for Bret to screw Shawn out of the title at Thursday Raw Thursday, causing Shawn to drop the title once again to Sid, with Shawn costing Bret the final four match a few days later. From there, said McMahon, the WrestleMania title match would become Sid versus The Undertaker, while Bret would face Shawn in a ladder match with Shawn's hair on the line, with Bret shaving the boy toy's head.
You what?
That just sounds ridiculous. I'm sure I've read that, but I don't think I've heard it.
Bret queried as to what had happened to the plans for their match to be for the WWF title, with Vince claiming, "It's too predictable now, I'm changing it." Bret says that he saw the situation for what it was. Shawn was refusing to put him over for the title. This would change yet again 10 days later, when instead of facing Sid for the WWF title, Shawn forfeited the strap due to his career-ending knee injury. Thus, another new plan was needed, and fortunately for Bret and the WWF, they had one. What's interesting to think about here briefly is, if the plan was for Bret versus Shawn and Sid versus The Undertaker as the big matches, and we've looked at other stuff like Rocky versus Mero, Hunter and Goldust seems a bit of a lock, Furnace and LaFon versus the Bulldog, Mankind versus Vader. Where does Steve Austin fit on this card?
Yeah.
Special guest referee.
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Paul's adamant he'll be special guest referee.
Yeah. To the fatal four-way tag match.
Enter Stone Cold Steve Austin. We've seen pretty much every step of the Austin-Bret Hart feud, which in fact began long before Bret's return to WWF television, in October 1996 when Austin began throwing out Hart's name as the man he wanted to face. Bret would accept Austin's challenge with their match taking place at Survivor Series on November 17th. The match, which I'm sure by now everyone knows is a personal favourite, would see Bret Hart pick up the win after an extremely hard-fought contest. This, however, would not be the end of their conflict, something entirely consistent with Austin's character. Austin would win the 1997 Royal Rumble match, with the Hitman being the last man eliminated from the contest, despite the fact that Hart had ejected Austin several minutes earlier, whilst the referee's attention was diverted. Hart and Austin would next collide at In Your House Final Four on February 16th in a match to determine the new WWF champion following Shawn Michaels' vacation. that means vacation of the title, and he probably went on holiday.
Possibly.
Austin would be the first man eliminated from the bout, thrown over the top rope by the Hitman, though Stone Cold would return later on, his attempts at interfering against Hart backfiring, leading to Bret capturing his fourth WWF title. As we covered on our Raw is War episode, Austin would cost Bret the WWF title in a match against Sid the following night on February 17th, after actually preventing the match from happening on two separate occasions. A bout would then be set for WrestleMania, pitting Bret Hart against Steve Austin one more time, this time in a submission match with Ken Shamrock, later added as the special guest referee. The first ever UFC Superfight champion, Ken Shamrock, made his first appearance for the WWF at the Manhattan Center Raw on February 24th. Initially interviewed by Jerry the King Lawler, who wanted Shamrock to tell the world that they were good friends and that Lawler had taught him all of his submission holds, Shamrock would later speak with Todd Pettingill and be queried about the top matches at WrestleMania. Shamrock would predict that The Undertaker would defeat Sid, but would be evasive about a potential result in the Bret Hart-Steve Austin match. By this point, Shamrock had already actually signed with the WWF, allegedly at the urging of Bret Hart, with the Wrestling Observer speculating that this was a huge risk that will either pay off in the end as a great investment and a franchise player, or a better working, more charismatic version of Mark Henry.
What? Well, I'm confused by that. So they think Ken Shamrock's going to be a more charismatic Mark Henry?
Well, in terms of signing somebody from another sport,
okay.
And obviously Henry had his one match against Lawler and has been injured since, so you're either going to get a real financial success from it, or you might get something a bit better than that.
Mm.
Or Ken might take his trousers off.
More charismatic than Mark Henry?
Not 2011 Mark Henry.
Okay.
Shamrock, who at the time had been made offers to re-sign with the UFC or sign with New Japan Pro Wrestling, as well as potentially meeting with WCW, was offered what was reported to be a three-year, low seven-figure downside guarantee with a signing bonus and the option to get out after 2 years to sign for the WWF.
Shit.
Shamrock had actually debuted as a professional wrestler prior to his UFC fame in 1990 in the Carolinas under the name Wayne Shamrock, also using the names Vince Torelli and Mr. Wrestling in his early career.
Mr. Wrestling?
Taking a trip to Japan in 1992, Shamrock would compete in a match with kickboxer Don Nayaka Nielsen, held under shoot conditions, with Shamrock winning in 45 seconds via armlock. Seeing that contrary to what he had been told about wrestling, in so much as that nobody would pay to see real fights, Shamrock, alongside fellow wrestlers Minoru Suzuki and Masakatsu Funaki, formed Pancrase, a promotion that used professional wrestling rules, i.e. no closed fist punching to the head and rope breaks, but contested completely legitimate contests.
All right, like the Brawl for All.
Just like the Brawl for All. Following the promotion's launch, Shamrock would return to America to compete for the newly formed Ultimate Fighting Championship at their UFC 1 event on November 12, 1993. Featuring an eight-man tournament with the winner receiving $50,000, Shamrock, despite being fancied as co-favourite, would lose to eventual winner Royce Gracie in the semi-finals. Shamrock would contest big fights with Royce Gracie on April 7th, 1995 and Dan the Beast Severin on July 14th, 1995, ooh, with the latter having a rematch on May 17th, 1996. Shamrock and Severin's initial contest drew over 240,000 buys on pay-per-view, cementing Shamrock as one of the fledgling organization's early stars, with Shamrock also earning the nickname The World's Most Dangerous Man from ABC News as part of a special entitled The World's Most Dangerous Things.
Nice.
Despite, or perhaps because of the group's early success, the UFC would quickly draw the attention of US authorities, with Senator John McCain, no, not Bruce Willis in Die Hard, regarding the practice of mixed martial arts as human cockfighting, and waging a successful campaign to have the UFC removed from several cable systems nationwide, severely reducing pay-per-view revenue. With injuries mounting, money dropping, and generally feeling burnt out with fighting, Shamrock made the decision to sign with the WWF.
Very interesting.
John McCain, the same one that
ran for president.
Ran for presidency against Obama.
I believe so.
Yeah.
As we saw on Raw is War, Shamrock appeared on the March 10th episode being interviewed by Jim Ross. Allowing Ross to do much of the talking, Shamrock would be quickly interrupted by both Steve Austin and Bret Hart, making their feelings clear on his appointment as referee in their bout at WrestleMania. Shamrock would again appear the following week on March 17th, making Billy Gunn look like a chump and attempting to get over his ankle lock submission in the process of tapping out, something not common in wrestling prior to this, with the exception of Taz in ECW. On the same episode, Bret Hart would get his rematch for the WWF title with Psycho Sid, with the potential to change this bout back to being for the WWF title. Despite being held in a steel cage, interference would come from Steve Austin, this time on behalf of the Hitman, and The Undertaker in favour of Psycho Sid, both of whom wanted their shot at the WWF strap on this night. Sid would eventually emerge victorious, retaining the title after The Undertaker slammed the cage door in the face of Hart. Post-match, Vince McMahon would approach Bret Hart for an interview, querying whether the Hitman was frustrated. Frustrated wasn't the goddamn word for it. Bret would shove leader Nelson McMahon to the floor and explode, venting his frustrations over the state of the WWF since his return. Steve Austin, The Undertaker and Sid would all reappear, causing a brawl as the cage was being dismantled. Shawn Michaels would make an appearance as the show closed, wandering down to ringside while chaos reigned around him. How art imitates life, eh? With growing crowd support for anti-hero Austin and longtime fan favourite Hart losing support due to his character being perceived as a whiner and the ever-changing tastes of the audience and what they want in their protagonists and their antagonists, the stage is very much set for a WrestleMania match with a big fight feel, despite the fact it was never truly the plan to begin with.
So it was thrown together then?
It was.
But thrown together in a manner that worked.
Thrown together in a manner that has 6 months of backstory, but wasn't the original intention whatsoever.
Yeah, interesting.
So they did have a wealth of material to work with.
Yeah, this? I mean, that...
And that's why it feels legitimate.
Yeah, that Bret Hart-Steve Austin feud has so much backstory, but seemingly the plan was ultimately, which may have been formed long before Steve Austin gained any momentum, i.e. WrestleMania 12, was for Shawn to lose the title to Bret and possibly his mullet.
And for Mark Merrow to face every single person on the card.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, other than that, you obviously had the obviously scheduled Mark Merrow-Bret Hart match and the obviously scheduled Mark Merrow-Steve Austin match.
Double duty.
Tough night. Tough night for Merrow.
And Sable.
Howard Finkel welcomes the world's buffest referee to the ring,
yeah,
Ken Shamrock.
Yeah, he is jacked to shit.
Well, I thought, actually, that it was interesting that Ken Shamrock looks like his shirt is painted on.
Are his trunks painted on as well?
No, because you just see his, yeah.
Because he is wearing sort of skin-tight Lycra ref shorts, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
But so does Earl Hebner.
Lovely stuff. And he's got it sleeveless as well.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Ken Shamrock?
Up to now, in terms of our timeline, he's been very dull. Up to now, when we see him, he looks pretty dangerous.
But
with the knowledge of what he becomes, I really quite like him.
Yeah, that was what I was aiming for. Your kind of memories of Ken Shamrock. Do you have any, Paul, or was he gone by the time you started watching?
Mostly gone. I've seen a couple of matches. The one that I've seen that I quite like is him against Mankind, where Mankind does the Mandible Claw on himself.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, because they do that brilliant bit, don't they, where it's like, and the winner via Mandible Claw is Ken Shamrock, and Shamrock goes mental. Yeah. When I first started watching again in, like, February 99, I loved Ken Shamrock.
Yeah, Shamrock's dead good.
Thought he was really good.
Sort of lunatic psychopath Ken Shamrock's much more interesting than really bland, boring Ken Shamrock.
Believably, legitimately, psychopathically dangerous.
Yeah, like, actually is dangerous, and once he gets that thing going, well, if he just punches himself in the head and shouts a lot, he looks mental.
Because here he looks like a buff accountant.
To go along with buff PE teacher British Bulldog.
Bulldog.
Yeah.
And buff Bagwell.
Glass smashes audibly. And we get a shot of Steve Austin walking through the backstage area. Glass smashes literally as Austin enters the arena to a mixed reaction, but nowhere near as big as Vince makes out on commentary.
No, I mean, I was quite interested by that bit, and I should have perhaps rewound it and had another look, but it almost looks like they haven't quite finely tuned the glass smash.
Right.
No, it kind of falls down.
Yeah, it's more of a crack and crumble than
when
a smash.
I think it gets better, doesn't it? This is the first time we've seen it, and it kind of it gets finessed where it cracks and shatters and then falls, whereas this one just kind of falls down.
Yeah, the pieces are too big.
Plus, it's a good job it's not like Stone Cold Fatu, as he came out with no shoes, because if he had to walk through broken glass, that
would be like John McClane.
Severely, dent the match and be a lot like Die Hard.
Maybe they should do that.
Bret the Hitman Hart gets fireworks as his music hits and another mixed reaction, although certainly more cheers than boos.
Yes.
The cheers are definitely overpowering when Bret enters the arena. Brett gives his sunglasses away and enters the ring to stare Austin down, but Austin charges him and they brawl on the mat, rolling to the outside. They exchange fists before Brett pushes Austin into the ring post, which makes a dull thud as he hits it.
Hmm. Well, I think suffice to say, we all quite like this match. Let's move on.
Yeah.
We don't really need to go into any more on it, I don't think.
I think everybody knows it.
Yeah.
Another long simmering feud is the one between Ahmed Johnson and Farouk. Austin suplexes Brett crotch first onto the railings and clotheslines Brett at Tony Atlas's feet.
Is this where we see there's a sign that says Austin for mayor? I was thinking, we've got Peter Soulsby as mayor in Leicester. Maybe we should get Stone Cold Steve Austin.
I would definitely vote for him.
Yeah.
That's not good. Jamie Vardy.
Yeah, he's clearly going to be made patron saint of Leicester by the summer, but Claudio Ranieri owns keys to the city, and Riyad Mahrez is just made king
of Leicester.
I would look, tell you what, Claudio Ranieri for mayor, genuinely, it's, as long as we all keep clean sheets, you can have a pizza.
Brilliant. But they've had like four out of the last five, so they obviously really like pizza. Austin follows Brett into the crowd with Ken Shamrock in tow, and the two brawl with Austin taking a second to steal a Coke and have a drink before throwing it at Brett.
There's also Bowl Cut Kid's in there somewhere.
Yes, Bowl Cut Kid is in there, and he has grown up quite a lot.
Yeah, I think he's lost a bit of weight around the face, but his bowl cut remains.
He's Bowl Cut Teenager.
Yeah.
Faith No More chap is not.
He's got a
well.
Blue World Order t-shirt on.
Mm. I thought it was a shame that he wasted the drink. Like, just imagine if when you're at WrestleMania, if there's a crowd brawl near you, and let's say Roman Reigns steals your Pepsi or whatever you have,
beer,
and just like wastes it, you'll be furious.
The brawl through the crowd certainly seems to get a big reaction, which is odd because normally that sort of thing doesn't because some people can't see it. So either there were some good big screens or they're just really hot for this happening.
Yeah.
In the bleachers, Austin looks to pile drive Brett, but Brett counters back body dropping Austin on concrete stairs. Yeah, that probably hurt. Austin and Hart make their way back to ringside, with Brett taking a hell of an Irish whip shoulder first into the steel steps.
Yeah, that was a beast.
Austin grabs the top half of the steel steps, but Brett kicks him in the gut and he drops them before any shot is made.
See, that's what happens. I'll be honest, the way that I looked at it, because I've probably been doing a bit of typing about some other stuff, I looked up and it just looked to me like he just dropped them.
I was really glad that he didn't drop them on his own head, because that was a distinct possibility.
So he did. So he did genuinely get a kicking, because it looked to me like
he gets a kick and then he drops them. Yeah,
I thought by his position, he looked like he was a bit too far away to actually reach him. Okay, well that makes more sense.
Austin drags Brett headfirst into the ring post before we head back into the ring. Brett hits a nice neck breaker for a pop as Vince wonders what excuse Brett will come up with if he loses this match, and he will have one. His horse was sick.
Yeah. I also point out at this point that Shamrock is way better at this than Roddy Piper ever.
Oh, Roddy Piper was the most annoying ref ever.
As like a celebrity ref whose job is to find out if someone quits, Shamrock's actually really good.
Well, there's a bit where it's probably about now where I assumed that Austin is swearing at him.
Probably.
He gets a laugh from the crowd.
Brett hits an elbow from the second rope and targets his attack on Austin's knee. Brett shouts for Austin to get up as he kicks away at Stone Cold's knee.
Oh, is this a bit? Because there was a really good medical analogy.
Go on, then.
Did you catch it? I don't know the exact words, but basically along the lines of Jai saying that Dr. Brett is doing a physical dissection of the patient Stone Cold Steve Austin. I like that.
Which is, again, odd, because about a year later, Steve Austin would pick up a career as a nurse.
Oh, that bit with Vince.
As a side note, that is probably my favourite delivery of any line in wrestling ever. He's absolutely brilliant. Austin evades Brett leaping on his knee, and out of nowhere hits a stunner as JR reminds us that pinfalls don't count.
Good pop for the stunner.
It really was from out of nowhere. That, I thought it was quite good. I quite like it when they do that in this kind of match, where they put in a finisher quite early.
And it was good in the fact that Stone Cold's clearly been battered in his knee.
Yeah.
So he pulls out the stunner to give himself enough time to actually get himself back on his feet.
Austin limps around the ring in some cracking selling as Brett kicks away at his injured knee. Brett drags Austin to the corner post and wraps his legs around it, locking in the ring post figure four for a huge reaction.
Massive reaction for that.
Big reaction. It's large.
Austin doesn't quit, however. Brett rolls Austin back into the ring and grabs the ring bell and chair.
He grabs a padded chair first of all, doesn't he?
And then
he changes it.
Tells Howard Finkel to move.
Yeah.
Brett sets Austin's ankle up inside the chair as Austin did to Pillman several months ago. The crowd go nuts for it. Brett heads to the top, but Austin gets up and hits Brett with a chair, knocking the hitman to the mat. And again, the selling on Austin getting up and just swinging wildly to get Brett down is brilliant.
But it's a nice, good wallop, but it's a safe wallop as well.
It is a safe wallop.
It's at the head, but he swings it slightly, so it hits the shoulder.
Yeah, head and shoulders, yeah. And the way that Brett tumbles down from the top as well was a nice bit of selling.
Austin nails Brett across the back with the chair and hits a slam and a suplex. Austin goes to the second rope, gives the fingers, and elbow drops Brett. JR tells us it's not about talking about it or talking about the past. It's not about posing or covering up bald spots. It's about athleticism and a hell of a fight between two great athletes.
What's that? Is that a dig at Hogan?
It's a dig at Hogan and Savage, etc. But they would have a hell of a time covering up Austin's bald spot.
You just need a wig.
Austin kicks Brett in the balls, and we get a shot of Brett's daughter at ringside, crying with her face in her hands.
She's worried about her daddy's balls.
To edit that out.
Yeah, that was a bit reminiscent of the shot of Foley's daughter at Rumble 99, or Foley's daughter at 99 is reminiscent of this shot. But sometimes when you see these really brutal matches and then their children happen to be ringside, it gets a bit disturbing.
Mm.
Austin hits a Russian leg sweep and locks in a submission, wrapping the back of his knee around Brett's head as an Austin chant gets going.
What was that move actually called? Because it looked a bit different. I quite liked it.
I honestly don't know what it's called. Feel free to let us know.
A leg arm thing.
Stu looks mildly concerned. Austin tries for a Boston crab for a pop, but Brett won't quit and makes the ropes. Austin looks to apply the sharpshooter, but Brett breaks it up before Austin can fully lock it in.
It's a nice little thumb to the eye, wasn't it?
Yeah. Austin's face, though, as he goes to put the sharpshooter on, is absolutely amazing. I can't quite work out how to describe it. It's angry pleasure. I think that's probably the best way of
smug fuck you.
Yeah.
Brett fights back, but Austin throws the hitman to the outside on a charge. Austin poses in the ring to big boos. Austin looks to Irish whip Brett into the timekeeper's table, but Brett reverses and Austin crashes into the guardrail. When Brett brings Austin out of the corner, Austin is bleeding.
Yeah, so I'm assuming he's bladed.
Brett shoves Austin into the ring steps as we see Austin's head and arm covered in blood. After a throw into the corner post, Brett rolls Austin back into the ring as we get a shot of blood dripping out of Stone Cold's head.
It is pouring.
Brett punches away at the cut on Austin's head before hitting a backbreaker and a second rope elbow drop. Brett grabs the chair and drives it into the back of Austin's knee, who flails away on the mat. Brett looks for the sharpshooter, but Austin rakes the hitman's face to cause the break. Brett punches away at Austin in the corner until Austin kicks Brett in the groin. Austin struggles to get to his feet, using the ropes to do so. He throws Brett sternum first into the corner and stomps away at the hitman, giving the hitman the double bird to a big pop.
Yeah, it's sort of into his swearing, and the swearing's very popular with people.
Austin sets Brett up on the top rope and hits a superplex. A close-up reveals the bloody mess Austin's face has become. Austin throws Brett onto the apron and grabs a reel of microphone cord. With Brett on the apron, Austin wraps the cord around the hitman's neck, but Brett grabs the ring bell and raises it above his head to clock Austin in the face.
Yeah, that's nice.
Also, if you've ever seen it, I think it's a little wee bit of a callback to the IC title match between Bret Hart and Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8, where it was Piper's like personal anguish whether to use the ring bell in that match or not against Brett. Mm-hmm. And here we are kind of 5 years later, and Brett, who was the ultimate babyface then, is using it now.
Mm.
Might not be, might just be a coincidence. Brett gets back into the ring and grabs Austin by the legs, locking in the sharpshooter to a massive pop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We see Austin fight and scream in pain as blood pours out of his forehead and he refuses to quit. Shamrock asks, and asks again, but Austin doesn't quit. Steve, do you quit? He says that really loudly.
Steve?
Steve!
Don't think he heard you. Austin fights, trying to pull himself up by his hands, howls in agony, a stream of crimson running down his face and into his mouth.
I thought it was nice. The bit where he kind of half escapes the hold really adds to it, because you kind of think, okay, he's going to get out of it, then something happens, but Brett just doesn't let go.
He manages to kick Brett down, but Brett retains the hold and Austin grabs and claws for the ropes. Brett wrenches on the hold as life seems to have left Austin, and Ken Shamrock calls for the bell, declaring Brett the winner at 22:05. JR tells us that Austin is unconscious and may have passed out from the pain, but he never gave up. Shamrock raises Brett's arm and checks on Austin as Brett paces around the ring, celebrating almost begrudgingly. As Austin lays face down on the canvas, Vince and JR call for doctors to assist him. Brett goes back to Austin, kicking away at Austin's injured knee and looking to put the sharpshooter back on, but Ken Shamrock wrestles the hitman away from behind to a massive pop.
Well, I thought that bit was really interesting when Ken starts to get involved in that way.
Shamrock is ready for a fight as the crowd go wild, but Brett leaves the ring to a chorus of boos. Brett slaps some fans' hands as he leaves, but faces the finger from several as well. In the ring, Austin pulls himself to his feet and stuns a referee that tries to help him. Austin leaves the ringside area on his own as big Austin chants break out. We get a nice shot of the bloodstained canvas as the segment ends, with Lawler questioning whether Bret Hart can feel proud of winning, given that Austin never quit.
Well, that's not his fault. But
good stuff. Really good stuff.
You liked it, didn't you, Adam?
Oh, I really enjoyed this. I thought this... you probably won't agree with me. I enjoyed this more than the Survivor Series match.
That's fine. I'm well aware that the Survivor Series one isn't the more popular one, and that's just a personal favourite.
I thought this was great. Like, really nice build, really well orchestrated. Really, really excited crowd for it. Great finish. Good story. Nice work by Shamrock. Yeah, spot on. Really, really enjoyed it.
I thought it was very good. I was talking to Adam before the show, and one thing, in terms of a wrestling match, I wouldn't say that this is better, for example, than Bret Riowin from WrestleMania 10. You know, it's obviously very good. The bit for me that makes this really good, though, is the bit after. Right. So it is Bret going back to attack Austin, Shamrock's intervention, and like you say, it's that reaction of when Bret is almost looking, thinking, weighing up in the mind, shall I go and have a fight with Shamrock? Kind of clearly comes to the decision, no, I'm knackered, that would be a bad idea. Walks off in that cowardly heel way. That, for me, is the moment that really cements this match, and the little detail as well, like the stunner from Austin after. So I think, in terms of the quality of the actual match, yes, it's very, very, very good. Not the absolute best match I've seen, but in terms of like the overall, like I said, it's the overall kind of storyline, the story arc, where it's going, the emotions involved, the crowd involvement, the kind of after-match intervention. Yeah, it kind of is a wonderful thing.
I'll put this notion to you. These two, in the span of about, 5 months, 6 months, have had 2 5-star matches that are completely, completely different.
Yeah.
Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I'd say they're very different matches. I'd say that I can't remember if I said it at the time, but looking back, the first one kind of felt kind of much more closer to kind of your normal Brett. I think I remember there was kind of hints of the more aggressive Brett.
Yeah.
But it was much closer to kind of your typical Brett match, which, you know, as we've discussed in the past, like, has this kind of slightly formulaic...
Yeah.
...feel to it, whereas this was a completely different match.
Yeah, character shift. Real distinct character shift, which makes the matches completely different. I mean, it's obviously the different stipulations in them, but...
I think stipulation really helped here.
Yeah.
In several ways. I think it helped them get away from that typical style of match. Obviously, it allowed them to do an ending that was convenient to get both of the characters where they wanted them to be by the end of the match as well.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really thoroughly planned. So was it, you know, one of the wrestlers' ideas to have a submission, or do you know kind of where kind of the Shamrock thing came from? Was, you know, was that Brett's idea to get Shamrock in to then play into this angle, or?
I'll go through some of that stuff in a minute. Quickly, the visual of Austin.
I'll tell you what, you know, it's that whole thing about blood being overplayed sometimes, and we talked about the Brett Bulldog and how that really helped to make that match from...
And even Vader a month ago. Yeah. Brett Bulldog at In Your House 5.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that this would have the same impact without the blood. Obviously, it'd still be a great match, but it wouldn't be the same.
If they're ever doing, like, a compilation now of great images from wrestling, this fits up there, doesn't it? It kind of goes into the same thing as Hogan staring down Andre, as Warrior lifting the two belts, Austin pissing blood out of his face, kind of just, it fits in with those images, which kind of tells you how important it actually is.
Aldo Montoya
with his new headgear.
Yeah.
Well, what can you say about this match? if you wanted to argue that it was one of the top five WrestleMania matches ever, nay, top five WWF matches ever, you could certainly put together a compelling case.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, when Bret Hart joined Steve Austin on his podcast in 2013, they ended up discussing this match, with the pair revealing that they were annoyed that it was even happening.
Wow.
The fact they were facing each other, the fact of the style of match.
The fact they were facing each other. Right. Bret would say that he felt that he and Austin had done everything they could in their Survivor Series match under the impression that that would be their only ever big singles match. When this bout was put together at the last minute with the added I quit stipulation, Bret recalled his contest with Bob Backlund at WrestleMania 11, claiming it was the only disaster match I ever had. Austin himself reveals that he found out about the match being booked while watching Raw on TV and was himself pissed off with the stipulation, as he damn sure didn't have any submission moves. It should also be noted, something that Austin also addressed, was that he had been kept out of the ring since the Final Four match in February due to having a tear of his posterior cruciate ligament, the back of the knee.
That doesn't sound good.
In addition to Bret Hart having knee problems of his own that will recur throughout 1997. However, contrary to this recollection, on the Steve Austin DVD Blu-ray set released in 2011, the Hitman notes that while he liked their Survivor Series match, he felt that they could do more. So,
yeah.
Which side of it you kind of feel like people have different impressions, I guess, as time goes on. In the same feature, both participants addressed the changing nature of the times when this match happened, with Austin saying he was doing everything he could to get booed, but it was becoming cool to cheer him. Austin describes the bout as the match happened as it happened, not with a bunch of prefab horse shit. That was a pro wrestling match. Going on to say that his face being covered in blood was a hell of a visual and fit perfectly. Hart said that he knew that ultimately this was a match that was going to change both of their destinies, and that he was grateful to Austin for putting his trust in him to get where he needed to go in the bout, i.e. Bret's the one who blades Austin.
Ah.
Okay, so it's Bret's suggestion to do the blood. Allegedly, Austin had never bladed before. Bret said, I'll do it for you.
Okay.
And supposedly there's a moment right before they do it where Austin says, I don't think we should, and Bret does it.
Mm. Wow. Mm.
And it's the right amount. It seems like a really weird thing to say about blading, but we've seen what happens when you blade too much.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it enough, it has no decent impact.
Yeah.
So it's just the right amount. And I guess the fact that Stone Cold is bald kind of helps with it, because the hair always...
And the sweat as well, because it kind of, I think,
yeah,
makes dilutes what blood
a
goes a lot further.
Yeah.
So,
no, good decision. As far as uses of blood go, it's one of the best ones.
CM Punk comments that the end stretch was a moment that could never be repeated. In his book, Bret says, I loved it. The match, everything. If I ever wanted my fans to remember just one picture of me, it would be that moment as I was walking back to the dressing room.
Hmm.
Wow.
Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer wrote at the time, it was expected to be a one-man show, and fortunately for the name WrestleMania, the one match delivered to match of the year caliber. Hart and Steve Austin more than saved the show with a match phenomenal in work rate, intensity, and telling a story. He wasn't lying either, as the match would go on to win the Observer's Match of the Year award for 1997.
Hmm.
A first time for the show, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we actually have a listener in the building for this one.
Really?
Andy from Chicago.
Oh, yeah, sir.
Who has sent me some thoughts on what he saw. He tells us, my best friend at the time was going with his mother and brother, but a couple hours before the show, I got the call that his brother didn't want to go and I was invited to replace him. My friend was more of a casual fan, and this was a cool period for me, so I don't even know if we knew what the full card was going to the event. Of this match, he writes, I must confess something. I had no idea a double turn took place. I was rooting for Bret because he was the good guy, and I didn't understand why he was being booed. How could people cheer for stunning Steve Austin? He had always been a bad guy. I still hadn't bought into Stone Cold being a killer. The brawling into the crowd was pretty awesome. Austin getting juice was great because I wanted his ass kicked. Bret winning made me happy. Attacking Austin after the match seemed justified. Shamrock tossing Bret around after the match had the crowd popping. Thoughts on that?
It's very interesting. And it's so easy to say, because obviously, like I've said before, I've known bits about this match. I've seen clips of this match, but I've never seen the whole match. Never seen it in context. And it's easy now to see a lot on what's going to happen in wrestling. And it's easy now to be a bit of a...
cynic.
Well, cynic or kind of, if you want to put it that way, but look like kind of smarter fan in that way in terms of...
seeing where things are going.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, okay, you've got the internet at the time, but it's not at the same level as it is now. So I can understand people not knowing quite what's going on, particularly if they hadn't seen all the build-up as well. Yeah. I think with the build-up, it makes more of a sense that you see the direction. And it's that thing where, it's to me, obviously, the Brett turn seems a very deliberate thing. The Austin thing, to me, seems like more of an accidental thing. It's something that I don't think was intended, but it slipped into it. That's just how the fans reacted. Let's then go with it.
Yeah.
So it started that way, and then it was embraced at later stages.
Thoughts on that?
Slightly strange, because it's in a position that I can't put myself in.
Right.
If you know what I mean, and it kind of echo a bit what Paul says, that it's easy to be smart about it. We know where things go. We've obviously seen all the context that goes into this. You tell us anything that we haven't seen, we know exactly what's happening. But if he's saying that he was more of like a casual fan and he wasn't watching everything at the time, but had been previously, obviously Bret Hart would be the good guy. And then to go into this without the knowledge of perhaps some of the shifts that were happening within the business, it is interesting to hear someone's perspective. I was kind of being there, but reacting in a way that wasn't current with the time, or wasn't as current with the time as lots of other people in the building.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear.
I mean, obviously, the picture that's painted of this match is that it's the best double turn in WWF history, and obviously it is. But, yeah, I think retrospectively, a slightly different version of that is told in the case that, yeah, very much Brett was on the road to being a heel, and he was, and Austin was very much on the road to being a face, and he was. But it seems to ignore that there kind of is this middle ground of there are still people cheering for Brett.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, there's plenty.
Yeah. And something we'll talk about next time we talk WWF is the following night on Raw, Brett will cut a promo very much designed to make it clear that he is the bad guy.
Mm.
So this will clear up any confusion for anyone in Andy's position, or anyone who wasn't quite sure, or anyone that thought Brett was justified in what he was doing.
Yeah.
The next night they will make a concerted effort to tell you Brett Hart is the bad guy, and here's why.
Mm. Mm. So, slightly different from like Hogan's turn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where that was painfully obvious who was the bad guy, then that had been done in such a manner with less ambiguity amongst the crowd, I guess.
But still, on both sides, the Hulk turn and the Brett turn, great storytelling.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, really, really good.
Even if one is more subtle than the other, and you might agree with some of Bret Hart's justifications and motivations, but
I'll tell you what, though, I do have a lot of sympathy with, maybe it's just because I quite like him, but I have that sympathy. I can see where he's coming from with all of these complaints and these bits of moaning. You kind of think,
He's got a point.
He's not helped out by everyone else on screen calling him a crybaby, which kind of influences the way that you think about him.
Well, I think it's quite clever, though. I mean, it's, you know, you can understand him, but you know, a hero doesn't bitch and whine like that.
Or doesn't do what he does after the match.
Exactly.
And a hero doesn't back away from fights like he backs away after the match.
See, that to me is interesting, because I think that is just smart. It is obviously, it plays into it that it is a good heel thing to do, to walk away. But it's just sensible. Like, you pick your battles. That's not being an idiot. It is what it is.
It's not seen as like idiocy, though, but it's not seen as a heroic trait.
Like, the Austin character would continually pick a fight when he is the hero, backing or refusing to back down against insurmountable odds.
Yeah.
But it's really good, and coming back to that point of Hogan and Brett, when they have a turn, because they're so ingrained as being the good guy.
Yeah.
And therefore the turn, when it takes place, has that much more meaning.
Yeah.
And if we then think about, the obvious exception is the Big Show, isn't it, who turns
flip-flops
when he comes in. You know, every 3 months he's going between face and heel. There, it has no meaning. When
Lex
you've got
Luger.
Someone that has built a career and has a reputation of 10 years based on being the good guy, when they flip to the bad guy, it feels so much more dramatic.
Although the Survivor Series match remains my personal favourite, it's hard to say anything negative about this one. It's also a major compliment to both that they could have two incredibly compelling five-star matches that are both completely different. If you've never seen this match, and I'm sure most of you have, you need to see it. And if you haven't watched it lately, watch it again.
Weirdly enough, I'm with Paul on this. I'd never seen this match all the way through.
No,
I'd seen it in probably most capacity, but in clips and in passing. But I'd never sat down and watched the entire match start to finish. Yeah, and it's absolutely fantastic.
And given it time, and it's quite nice to perhaps see it like we have, you know, in the context that we've seen over these last months to build up. You know, it's probably the closest thing that most people would get to seeing it in a relatively reasonable timeline, because I guess over about the last year, we've pretty much did a WrestleMania at a similar time last year.
Yeah, WrestleMania, I think, for us was, March
just before WrestleMania.
Year,
so I think, you know, we've seen this last year coming at kind of the relative pace that it did.
Yeah.
So we've had the build-up at the right pace, and we've seen everything that's gone on. As you say, Stuart Fields is in very nicely on the bits that we don't see.
And we've seen a massive change in the business. Well, like the last, we've watched a chronological year of wrestling and dipping between WWF and WCW, and the business has kind of flipped.
Yeah.
And so it's been a real fascinating year of wrestling to watch, I think.
Vince, submission matchup over next. Ahmed Johnson, Legion of Doom, set to meet the Nation of Domination. There are 2x4s. There are billy clubs. There are garbage cans. There are nunchucks. You guys have everything but the kitchen sink.
Well, you forgot they're the thugs also. They say the crooks and the criminals come out at night. Well, guess what? They're out tonight in Chicago. And that punk, colored boy Ahmed Johnson, and the Road Warrior, they're going to get just what's coming to me. You think I don't have the kitchen sink? Well, just wait and see.
Todd Pettengill is stood by with the Nation of Domination.
Sweet.
He lists the various weapons available, saying they have everything but the kitchen sink. Farouk says, wait and see, as we cut to the arena.
I think he says billy clubs at one point.
Yeah.
What are billy clubs?
That's a thing. Daredevil uses them, doesn't he?
Is it like a kind of stick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a stick.
But yeah, it's just a stick.
You're just disappointed no one's got a cricket bat.
Yeah.
I am.
It was a short promo.
What's that tag team that we saw at Southside that had the cricket bat?
The London Riots.
Excellent, yeah. I like them. Although it looked like they probably needed a new bat.
Up next is Ahmed Johnson and the Legion of Doom against the Nation of Domination in a Chicago street fight. Another feud, with nearly a year's build to it, is the conflict between Ahmed Johnson and Farouk, dating back to the 22nd of July 1996 Raw, when Farouk first debuted as a blue-helmeted gladiator, kicking Ahmed in the kidneys, causing the Pearl River powerhouse to miss 6 months of action. In the interim, Farouk received a change of gimmick, forming the Nation of Domination at Survivor Series, alongside Crush, Clarence Mason, rappers PG-13, and a bunch of nameless goons, including D'Lo Brown.
You said nameless goons, including D'Lo Brown, but he has a name.
Shut up. Ahmed would get his first shot at Farouk at the Royal Rumble, but nothing would be settled after interference from various Nation members. Later in the evening, Ahmed would eliminate himself from the Royal Rumble match before returning later to attack Farouk with his now trademark massive plank of wood.
Dumbass.
A week later, on January 25th at Madison Square Garden, Savio Vega would turn on Ahmed and join the Nation during a tag team match where he partnered Ahmed against Farouk and Crush.
Classic.
He would deny joining the group a little later in the evening for reasons I'm yet to ascertain. Following In Your House Final Four on February 16th, the match between Ahmed and Farouk would be quickly set for WrestleMania, with Farouk the next night on Raw demanding that it be made a Chicago street fight. Ahmed would accept the challenge on the March 3rd Raw, but stated that he would not be coming alone. 1 week later on the March 10th Raw, Ahmed would reveal what he meant. The Legion of Doom would be joining him.
Nice.
The LOD had returned on the February 24th Raw from the Manhattan Center in an ill-advised 11-minute match against the Headbangers that went to a double countout before saving The Undertaker from a post-match beatdown at the hands of Farouk and The Nation to close the broadcast.
You what?
Hawk and Animal would take on Savio Vega and Crush on the go-home March 17th Raw is War, as both Ahmed Johnson and Farouk watched on from backstage before the inevitable multi-man brawl. On the March 22nd, Shotgun, Sonny, in a Undercover with Sonny segment,
nice,
would attempt to create rumours that prior to their return, the Legion of Doom had been contacted by Clarence Mason and would turn on Ahmed at WrestleMania. Her segment the previous week hyped on the Raw is War debut episode that actually ended up getting cut for time, but apparently, in it, she claimed that Ahmed was the illegitimate son of Arnold Skoland and Juanita Wright.
Unlikely. Who is Juanita Wright?
Sapphire.
In that case, that is very unlikely.
That is very unlikely.
Who's Sapphire?
Dusty Rhodes' valet from the early 90s. Oh, and let's never forget the time Ahmed gave D'Lo the Pearl River Plunge on the roof of that car. Vintage Ahmed Johnson.
I think, you know, when we finished the podcast and you think back to what are the favourite memories of things that you've seen, that will stay with me, I think, because it's such an odd image.
I'm really shocked because I didn't think any memories stayed with you.
Some do.
It's actually pretty impossible to describe this match in the manner that I normally do, so let's just discuss it in bullet point format. Legion of Doom, Ahmed Johnson, looks fucking badass.
Yeah. He does, yeah. He should carry on with this.
I think it is quite a good thing, because they do talk about, are they allowed to use the spikes?
No.
They should be.
But if it's... And what is the difference between a Chicago street fight and just a street fight?
This one's in Chicago.
Is that the only difference?
Presumably.
We could have a Leicester street fight.
We could.
But let's not.
Let's not dwell on how amazing Ahmed Johnson looks in Legion of Doom gear. Let's not gloss over that.
It's the best that he's looked.
Yeah. He does need an LOD name, though, and I think I've got it. Hawk, Animal, and Botch.
Botch. Plank.
Hawk, Plank. Animal, and Plank. Plank. Yes, that's it.
The only thing about having that plank of wood, it reminds me too much of Hacksaw.
No, Ahmed's owned it for himself.
Yeah.
He's reclaimed it.
He's way better.
You know who has claimed it? LOD, because they've written their LOD on their plank of wood.
If you write your name on something, it's yours.
Yeah. Well, so no one else uses it.
Yeah.
The kitchen sink is there.
Hilarious.
Is it Hawk that brings that?
Yeah. So presumably Farouk had seen him with it backstage. Because it's Farouk that says, oh, just wait and see, when Todd says... Everything but the kitchen sink.
Well, it's a single bowl, though, isn't it? So it's not like a 1.5.
No.
I really wanted, when we got our kitchen done last year...
You wanted a rinser?
I wanted a rinser, but I wasn't allowed it because it would like make it about 5 millimetres too big for our cavity that we had.
Bastard.
Cavity.
It's a Ahmed dirty word, isn't it?
Wallops Clarence Mason in the face.
And everyone loves it.
Young Colt Cabana gets in on the action, wailing on Hawk's back.
That is weird.
What?
When they brawl up the crowd, there's a guy on the left, I think he's in an ECW t-shirt. That's Colt Cabana.
Really?
Really.
Did not notice that.
Yeah, I don't think it's the sort of thing you'd probably notice unless you were paying really specific attention, but he talks about it on his podcast and stuff, so
okay.
It is him. Dangerous Ahmed dive into the crowd, followed by dangerous Ahmed dive out of the crowd.
Absolutely back to his best.
And the best part about the latter one is that it happens in the background.
Yeah, something else is happening, isn't it?
In the foreground, yeah.
He's just hurling himself over everything.
Amazing.
I did write that this is hard to follow. This kind of tornado rules.
Yeah, but it's exceptionally good fun.
Mm. Spot of the millennium. You ready? Hawk looks to whack Savio with Ahmed's plank. It bounces off the turnbuckle really high in the air, and he catches it.
It was a marvellous catch.
That was 5 stars.
It's probably the wrestling equivalent of one of those catches where somebody catches it just inside the boundary, but their momentum's going to take them over the boundary, so they have to throw it up in the air.
Jump back up
and catch it just inside. It was really lovely stuff.
Animal botches a pile driver to Farouk on a flimsy table.
That's unfortunate, but I was kind of glad because it looked like it was going to kill someone.
Yeah, I can't believe that they were going to do that. I cannot believe. And I also can't believe they messed it up so badly. But like Adam, I was relieved that it didn't happen. Mm. It quite possibly saved his life. Horrible looking spot.
Plus, that table has a better use about 5 minutes later on. Fire extinguishers.
They use a powder fire extinguisher.
Which are really messy to clean up.
Which are incredibly messy, yeah. I was going to say, later on, they stop using that and use a CO2 one, yeah. Which looks as impressive but causes less
mess. It's more comical. You get that plume that really travels around the ring later on, don't you?
Mm,
did you notice it? Like, it almost turns the corner.
It would have really pissed you off if you were in the...
In the crowd.
In those rows.
Hawk puts a bin on Savio's head and then full-on whacks him in the face.
Nice.
Ahmed slams Farouk through the flimsy table in just the most Ahmed Johnson manner ever.
I love that we're still in this time period as well where, like, monitor's on the table, fuck it, leave it. It'll be fine.
Yeah, that probably won't hurt at all. Massive LOD chance.
Yeah.
The Nation tries to use a noose to hang Ahmed.
I really don't want to ever see a noose in a wrestling match.
What about that time the Big Boss Man got hung from the Hell in a Cell?
I didn't really want to see it then. I mean, I like Hell in a Cells.
Not when people get hung in them, though.
It's just like, what are you trying to achieve by doing this?
Hanging.
Kill.
Well, yes. But, like, no. Like,
You can't do that.
You can't do that.
This is the problem. Is I know the guests are trying to get a bit edgier, but you've got young kids in the crowd, and if I had Baby Scrivens there, if I took him to a wrestling match, and okay, you expect to see a fair bit of violence and fighting, and although if you know you're going to get a street fight, you know it's going to be a bit of
on the aggressive side.
You don't expect to see somebody hung with a noose.
Mrs. Scrivens might like it though, because she likes the violent wrestling.
Yeah, I'm not sure she'd like that. I just don't think it's a nice image, and what, I don't think it does anything for the match.
What about those tickets for you and Baby Scrivens you bought for CZW last week?
Yeah, unfortunately we can't make it because it's in America.
Hawk gets hung also, but drags Farouk to the outside from the top rope.
Yeah, he's not having any of it.
D'Lo Brown tries to get revenge on Ahmed's kidneys, but Ahmed kicks him in the balls.
Right square in the balls as well.
Farouk gets the noose, but Ahmed forgets how hanging works and nobody has the other end. Just putting that out there. There's a note here, or a bullet point rather, that says, no, D'Lo, don't stay in the ring alone with Ahmed. This will not end well for you.
Poor D'Lo Brown has had his head kicked in by Ahmed Johnson so many times.
I presume this is actually why they give him a full-time job and roster spot, because it's like, yeah, we should probably just do something for
it's
this
almost
kid.
Like he's building up credit order to gain a job.
LOD hit the Doomsday Device to crush, and Ahmed and Hawk plank him with Animal covering for the pin and the win at 10:45.
Again, I was discussing this with Adam earlier. It's seemingly a member of PG-13 that hands Ahmed Johnson the plank.
Really?
Yeah. I noticed this. It's from the back of the ring as we're looking at it. But it's almost like someone realised the plank down here, Ahmed Johnson should have it. Oh, fucking hell. He's about to do something. He's not got his plank.
The big ending. We've not got the... It's the one thing we didn't want to happen.
The plank. Who's got the plank? Give it Ahmed.
Vince quote of the night, it's not over, although officially it is. Post-match, Ahmed Pearl River plunges D'Lo, thankfully not on an automobile, and the LOD and Ahmed hit a double doomsday advice to murder PG-13.
I've got to admit, like, you don't like the look of that. You think it looks very dangerous, but I thought it looked awesome.
Doomsday device looks dangerous.
Awesome, but really dangerous. It's basically turning a man inside out via the neck from about 6 foot in the air.
I thought it looked spectacular.
Yeah, that's why it looks really dangerous.
My final bullet point on this match is two words. Ahmed's buttock.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, I've got Ahmed's buttock is out. It's
managed
back. It's remained elusive for most of this match, but in the celebration, he has his right buttock firmly out.
His buttock remained elusive.
So, booking a street fight after an I Quit match could be probably considered pretty crappy booking, but you know what? This is fucking amazing. It actually works, and it's such a different match to the one before it in so many ways that they don't clash despite being next to each other.
Yeah.
And against every single possible expectation anyone could have ever had of these six men in this match, it just was good fun, unless, I guess, you were PG-13 or D'Lo Brown. And it's more than likely the best crush match in existence.
Yeah. I thought this was good fun. I think that is the best way of describing it. It's all over the place. Story? There is no story. But there's a plank in a kitchen sink and six bastards kicking each other's heads in. So it's fine.
You see, I think you guys were a lot higher up on this match than I was, I'll be honest with you. I didn't hate it. But one of the things that was quite nice, it was quite brief.
Yeah.
For a six-man...
It's 10 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's what it needed to be after the I Quit match.
I think that was fine. I think for me, the fact that it was so all over the place, it was very difficult to follow. Like you say, there's no storyline after you've just come out such a storyline heavy. It is such, again, I'll use that phrase, chalk and cheese, just because somebody said the lights the other week, that I don't know. I didn't hate it, and certainly liked some of the spots, but I did not like the use of the noose.
I think it is the wrestling equivalent of a palate cleanser.
Yeah, yeah.
You're saying that this is a lemon sorbet?
Yep.
Ahmed Lemon Sorbet Johnson.
This is not... A Chicago Street Fight is not a palate cleanser.
Anything, it might be like, in CZW.
This is just like sandpaper to the tongue and inside of the mouth.
Palate aggravator.
Wait, smooth, maybe it smooths it off.
palate sander.
I can legitimately see that when we get to the end of this timeline and we do a show, something like the, you know, our personal 10 best matches from the show, I can see this certainly being on my list and being part of the discussion.
It won't be on my list.
I really like it.
Mine would just be like 10 Hogpen matches.
And this would just be such a great point to end the Ahmed Johnson Farouk feud, wouldn't it?
Does it end it?
No.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, we've got to go for another 4 years.
Because this has been very protracted, right? Ahmed's been injured for a long time, but this is a nice blowout to it. Ahmed's won, the nation have been defeated. Job's a good one, right?
No.
Oh.
After another advert for In Your House, oh look who invited himself to WrestleMania and then actually turned up. It's the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels.
Now, I saw this entrance whilst you were watching it, Stuart.
Yeah.
So he was watching it. I was like, bloody hell, this is going on a bit. So when I was watching it again today, I decided to fast forward his entrance.
Yeah.
So I fast forwarded. I thought, it goes on for a while. 4 minutes.
4 minutes.
And then I press play and he's still going.
Obviously, he gets the longest entrance of anyone on the show, with the most pyro of anyone on the card, despite the fact that he isn't even wrestling, his music even loops.
Mm. Yes. It just goes on forever.
Credit where credit's due. He remembers to limp a little bit this time.
Yeah, he does. I did notice. Yeah.
Lawler doesn't want Shawn to join the announce team, and Vince describes him as prime pork. That's fucking weird.
Well, no, can I tell you something, right? So, because he talks about a love fest. Yes, it's a love fest from you, Vince.
I think he says prime pork because I think he's saying he's not a ham.
Right,
he's
okay.
Prime pork. But if you just take prime pork as what he says, yeah, there's all sorts of weird connotations.
I think
in that
could be another one of your nicknames, mate. Prime pork, Paul Scrivens.
I tell you what, that'd be that could work.
But again, it does yield a really great Lawler line. JR, what would WrestleMania be without Shawn Michaels? Lawler. Better.
Maybe a love fest going on in the arena, but that love is about to turn to rage. This man, the World Wrestling Federation champion, Psycho Sid, has defeated Shawn Michaels. He has defeated Bret Hart. And tonight, Psycho Sid, this could be the most important night of your WWF career as you meet The Undertaker.
Guy Pettigill, you are right, my friend. WrestleMania is the biggest event of the world. And it comes once a year. But tonight, darkness falls, every man, woman, and child will be scared, except for one person. Only one person is not scared of the darkness, and one person is not scared of the Undertaker, and that is me, my friend. In the game we play, I am the master, and I am the ruler of night.
Todd Pettengill is stood by with Sid. He quickly botches his promo, talking about WrestleMania being the event of the world. Sid says he isn't scared of The Undertaker and gets extra, extra, extra whispery.
Yeah, to the point where I couldn't really hear what he was
saying. No, me neither. And the TV was turned up reet loud. It's time for our main event. It's Psycho Sid versus The Undertaker for the WWF World title. Similar to what we discussed about the Intercontinental title match earlier in the show, there will be a strong case for arguing that this match has the least build for any WrestleMania main event contested for the WWF title, unless you count that time Hulk Hogan beat Yokozuna in like a minute. When Psycho Sid captured the WWF title for the second time from Bret the Hitman Hart on the February 17th Raw, this match would simply be set up by The Undertaker wandering out post-match to stare down Sid, with the announcers talking about how Taker was the number one contender to the title and would face Sid on March 23rd. After both men cut promos on Shotgun Saturday night hyping the match, including Taker demanding that this show be referred to as WrestleMania the 13th, Sid and Taker's first big interactions would come on the March 10th Raw is War. Opening the rebranded show, champion and challenger would confront one another before being interrupted by Vader and Mankind, their tag team opponents for later in the evening, resulting in a brawl between the two duos that teased miscommunication between Taker and Sid. Simmering tensions would boil over in the main event, with Taker hitting the chokeslam to Sid and Sid powerbombing The Undertaker. Despite Sid's match with Bret Hart on the March 17th Raw is War being for the WWF title, this bout would retain the honour of having the title on the line for the reasons we discussed earlier. And finally, despite the urban myth attributed to it, this is not the match where Sid shits himself going up for the tombstone. Supposedly that was years earlier.
Ah. Well, so talk us through that story, because I did ask Adam about this earlier.
The story is Sid shit himself when he goes up for the tombstone.
That must have been really unpleasant for The Undertaker.
I take it as an accident, not some kind of protest.
Not some sort of dirty protest, no.
As I don't want to take
you. I'll show you.
That old prankster Sid thinks, I know what, I'll crap myself as soon as my arse is close to his face.
Oh, that's horrible. Horrible.
It's not the best Sid Urban myth, though, is it?
What's the best Sid Urban myth?
The one about how he kept a squirrel with him at all times and put it down his trousers and it bit his knob.
It's not a myth, is it?
Well, presumably that's a myth.
I've heard it on the internet. It must be true.
Why would you keep a squirrel in your trousers?
Where else are you going to keep it?
A bag?
There's so many great Sid stories, though. The one where him and Arn Anderson kill each other with scissors. The one where he tries to attack Brian Pillman with a squeegee. It's just endless gold.
Squeegee.
Has Sid written a book? Well,
Nobody should. Been
helped to write a book.
I must say, the one thing I'm really gutted about Hall of Fame is that I so hope Sid was going in.
Yeah, I wanted Sid or Vader to go
in. And he's not at WrestleCon. Like, oh, man, I'd love to meet Sid.
Yeah.
The Undertaker enters the arena to a slightly quiet reaction, and I'm sure a shot in the crowd shows someone holding up what looks like a miniature blowtorch.
What?
You know how people hold up lighters? There's definitely one that looks like a small blowtorch.
Like one of the ones you'd have for cooking and sorting out
creme brulee. Yeah, like doing creme brulee. Yeah, one of those. You probably won't get that in WrestleMania this year. I've had a big email about what we're not allowed to take in.
So what can't you take?
No blowtorches.
No blowtorches. Raising the lights gets a big pop and an exclamation from Vince.
Yeah. Oh my God, he turned the lights on.
JR references Taker wearing the same attire that he wore at his first WrestleMania and tells us that Taker has never lost at this event. Shawn Michaels has joined the commentary team. Sid gets big boos when his music hits. Where did they come from? Did he turn heel that afternoon and we've missed it?
Unfortunately, is Sid over now?
Sid is over and Sid is still a face. And this is the weird thing about this match.
But no, I mean, I'd like, not as in over with it. Is Sid over?
Oh.
Is our great period of Sid gone?
Yes.
It's a sad time. I will remember fondly when Sid was the best.
We'll always have Survivor Series 96, Adam.
Yeah. Who's the man? Sid's the man.
Maybe just Chicago's a big Undertaker town. Okay, maybe Sean being on commentary will be good as quickly we get this gem from Lawler. When Sean is talking about Sid being afraid of the Undertaker, he says of Sean, I'm afraid you're a big liar.
Yeah, I always get the impression from this that Lawler don't like Shawn Michaels.
Well, he shit in his crown, didn't he?
What a bastard.
That was maybe not him, it was probably Sean Waltman, but there was the story about the Click shitting in his crown.
Like, actual crown?
Actual one of his crowns, yes. They actually took an actual human shit.
The Click as a group...
That wasn't covered on the Blu-ray.
No, it wasn't, was it?
They're sure like dumping in people's things.
Crowns, dinners, bags.
Yeah.
Is that where Randy Orton got it from?
Presumably.
She just wanted to be part of the Click.
JR sets this match up as being about the tombstone versus the powerbomb. Sid's fiery pyro goes off to more boos. As the bell rings, Bret Hart walks down the aisle. Sean digs at Bret being resentful for not being in the main event, and Bret enters the ring and demands a microphone.
I got news where he did his best against Steve Austin, and he couldn't quite get it done.
What's this? Sean?
Yo. First of all, you phony little faker, why don't you take your little pussyfoot injury?
No.
It's all right.
No.
I'm not going anywhere.
And go back and find your smile, but whatever you do, stay out of this match.
I'm so scared.
And as for you, I just want you to know, when you slam that door on my head, you slam the door on our friendship, and from here on in, it's a new set of rules between you and me.
Oh my, I can't remember the last time Brett was anybody's friend.
And you... You know, and I know, and every single person in this building
knows that he's a crybaby.
One thing, that World Wrestling Federation Championship belt belongs to me, and you are a fraud.
Well, it looks like Brett.
That belt never belonged to you, and you know it, and I know it, and every single person in this building, whether you're here or outside in TV land, you all know that I am the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be.
Oh! Brett calls Sean a faker and tells him to take his pussyfoot injury and find his smile. Yes, you fucking tell him.
I quite like that, although Sean does say something snarky on commentary, doesn't
well,
he?
Well, the camera shot goes back to Sean, who has Vince stood over him, like massaging his shoulders, like, no, you're a good boy.
I took it more as... Don't worry about what he's saying. Yeah. You're the best.
Don't listen to the nasty man.
Yeah.
It's a bit creepy.
Well, I thought it was a bit annoying that Sean doesn't shut up for the promo. Like, just doesn't get his role here.
Does it surprise you?
No, but I felt a little bit let down.
Brett tells Sean to stay out of the match and tells Taker that he has slammed the door on their friendship. Good metaphor.
Yeah, but were they actually friends before? Were they good buds?
They were both baby faces. That technically means they were pals.
Did they play dominoes together?
Maybe. Brett tells Sid that the title belongs to him, so Sid clocks him round the head and hits a powerbomb. Sid asks for a microphone and tells Brett to take his whining ass out of there. Officials help Brett out of the ring, and Sid tells him, hobble along, crybaby. And before he can say much else, Taker attacks Sid from behind.
I do believe that Sean is making wah, wah.
Did they also cut, I don't know what where it falls, but did they cut some of Sean's dialogue? He says something about Brett's been shafted more times, and then it just cuts.
Oh, okay.
I didn't catch that.
And then the commentary picks up again.
Presumably it just said Sonny.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking that's maybe where he was going with it.
Bit weird to open your WrestleMania main event with, like, someone else running down, having a bit of a chat, bit of a powerbomb.
My theory is that just to shorten this match, my genuine thoughts about, because I did think about that, I wrote it in my notes, that it just, they probably know that they haven't got enough time to fill a WrestleMania main event with these two guys in a competitive match. So I actually thought it's quite sensible.
Taker hits a big boot in the corner and wails away on Sid before hitting a big splash. Taker hits a scoop slam and covers for a two. Taker hits old school and Sean is confused on commentary, saying it must be different for both men to be in there and not be the biggest man. Mm. Unless the referee is 8 foot tall, one of them is bigger.
Yeah. Should have had that.
Taker looks to splash Sid in the corner, but Sid counters, grabbing Taker in a bear hug. Rest in peace, Chance, as Taker tries to fight back. This goes on for a while.
Yeah, there's a lot of rest holds in this match.
Sid eventually lets go and clubs Taker in the base of the spine before reapplying the bear hug. And Sean gives a revealing line on commentary. You can't always control being the most popular guy, but you can control being the winner. Well, you can.
Yeah.
Not so sure about everyone else. Taker eventually breaks the bear hug but walks into a Sid big boot. Sid clotheslines Taker to the outside, but Taker lands on his feet and tries to yank Sid out with him, but Sid kicks Taker backwards over the Spanish announce table. Sid drops Taker over the guardrail, neck first a couple of times, telling the referee to shut up while he does so. Sid slams Taker onto the Spanish table, but it doesn't break, instead falling over with Taker on it.
Yes, a sturdy table.
Sid rolls Taker back into the ring and covers for a two. Sid applies a slightly better version of the camel clutch than he used to do, continuing to focus his attack on the lower spine. Sid hits an axe handle from the second rope and asks the crowd who the man might be.
Probably Sid. There's a bit where they're outside and there is all that shit all over the floor, isn't there?
You've still got a powder
extinguisher. And JR says, it looks like Twister. And it took me a while to think about the film. It actually means the film.
Not the game.
It was released in 97, or the ice cream bar.
It's not got coloured spots on the floor.
Yeah.
That would have been crazy. Maybe they should do that in a wrestling match sometime. They can only wrestle in portions where they've got a particular coloured spot. So you can put your right hand on Vader's leg.
Or actually, thinking about it, I'm amazed that never during the Attitude Era did they ever do like a bra and panties twister game between the Divas.
Yeah, that would have been good.
Adam's face, like, right then, looks genuinely disappointed that never happened.
It was just below zero on his scale.
We've made him emote.
That was perhaps a little frustration and anger there.
Taker fights back, but Sid retains the advantage with a power slam for a trio of three counts, shouting, God damn it, when they don't work. Sean calls Sid out on it, wondering why you'd pin someone three times without any additional offense between pinfall attempts. He is right. Sid hits a leg drop for another pair of twos, and Vince informs us that Steve Austin's leg is in a bad way, but that he's refused medical help. Lawler informs us that Brett is somewhere whining, with Sean chiming in with, I've got an update on Brett. I hear he doesn't like me. Vince gives a nervous laugh in response. Taker hits a jumping clothesline for a pop, but Sid gets up first. Taker throws Sid to the outside and throws Sid into the crowd, and they exchange fists either side of the guardrail. Taker brings Sid back over and shoves him face first into the steel steps. Back in the ring, Taker misses on an elbow drop and Sid applies a chin lock. Taker powers out and hits rapid-fire fists to the body of Sid and hits a slam to take Sid down. Taker covers and gets a two. Taker looks in the Vulcan nerve grip, but Sid powers out. Sid looks for a big boot, but Taker catches it, spins Sid around and hits a clothesline for a two. That was probably about the nastiest spot of the match. We follow this with a double big boot spot, but it's not shown from the best camera angle and both men go down.
I like how it's commented on, stereo feet to the face. I quite like that.
I don't think I actually picked up that was boots.
Yeah, the angle doesn't make really it look weird, like it. Yeah. Sid is the first up and covers for a two. Sid heads the second rope a couple of times and hits an axe handle and a clothesline with the latter yielding a two. A third trip to the top and Taker blocks another axe handle with a right hand to the gut. Sid gets a scoop slam and heads to the top rope. No, really.
Mm. Yeah, I was a bit worried about that when he went up.
Taker, however, sits up and crotches Sid on the turnbuckle. Taker lifts Sid back up and slams him off. Taker heads to the top rope and hits a clothesline and Sid gets back to his feet. Taker signals it's time for the tombstone to a big pop. He sets Sid up, but Sid wriggles out of it and reverses it, hitting a nasty-looking one of his own.
Mm. Well done, Sid.
Yeah, I thought that's brave of Taker to let him do it.
Sid gets a two from his effort. Sid throws Taker to the outside, and as they brawl, Bret Hart appears with a chair and clocks Sid round the back with it before officials drag the hitman away. Taker rams Sid spine-first into the ring post and rolls him into the ring. Taker grabs Sid by the throat and chokeslams him to a big reaction, covering for a two.
Nice chokeslam on someone that big.
Mm.
In a weird spot, Sid apparently ducks a flying clothesline, but it looks kind of botched and Taker flies over him, doubled over.
Yeah, I've put it as a jumping, running nothing. I didn't know what it was.
It was exactly what you labelled it as.
Yeah.
Sid sets up for the powerbomb, but Bret Hart comes out again. Sid decks Bret on the apron, but Bret drops Sid neck first over the top rope, causing Sid to turn around right into a tombstone from The Undertaker for the three at 21:19, winning Taker his second WWF title to a big pop. Vince describes Sid as being not a happy camper, which is just such a weird phrase to use here and in this context.
Yeah. That's not what you'd say if a kid had lost their ball or something.
Yeah, or their balloon had gone off. Yeah. Taker poses in the ring, holding up the title as the lights go down. It sounds like a single person in the entire audience is clapping, but I presume it's Sean on commentary. Mm.
Yeah, it kind of does have a feel.
Vince wonders if Taker's tear will disappear now he's champion.
You'll rub it out.
Yeah.
Weird way to finish.
Not a great match, really. 20 minutes and very dull.
I didn't really expect, like, much as I like both of these guys, I wasn't really expecting a 5-star classic. I think the interference actually helped it.
Well, that was where my next question was going. Where do you stand on that?
I was saying earlier that we should have perhaps had more. You disagreed. No, no.
You should have been booked to buggery and just had loads of people run out.
Not, I don't know, maybe you think this would be what I would have done if I was Vince.
Go on.
No, it's similar. So I'd have had Bret come down, and I'd have had Austin coming down in the face way to get rid of Bret, not just to get his hands on Bret, though, is to allow this title match to take place.
Right.
Because I think that would be a face thing to do, and if they want to cement that, it would allow him to get a bit of revenge on Bret, which I think people would like.
Yeah.
It would give another distraction to this match, which I don't think would be a bad thing, and I think he would come out of it being more face.
It's a bit of a letdown as a main event, really. It's way too long with no real existing issue, I think, is the other thing. And as I've mentioned, like, despite the Chicago crowd treating Sid as a heel, he isn't really a heel. They pick him as one, but he hasn't turned heel. Next night on Raw, he begins a feud with a heel that sort of begins here. So what was the issue? The Taker-Diesel match last year was only 5 minutes shorter. I thought that was a lot shorter. Mm-hmm. So I went and looked. But that was just a lot better. So maybe if some time had been shaved off, they hopefully could have produced something akin to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, a letdown. Not one that I'd really ever want to go back and watch. You could watch this pay-per-view and just stop it after the street fight.
Thoughts on the show overall, then?
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it overall, I think. It's obviously, it's massively helped out by the Bret Austin match and, from our perspective, the street fight. But I didn't mind the tag title match, I don't think, as much as you two.
Yep.
I didn't mind the Goldust Triple H match. So, really, actually, from that sort of point, I kind of either liked or was not offended by more than I thought was rubbish. So I'd give it a positive overall.
I didn't think any of it was bad at all, I thought. it was mediocre.
Is that not worse than bad?
What's that, sorry?
Isn't mediocre not worse than bad?
Mediocre is better than bad.
Oh, okay, just checking.
For me, on my scale,
right,
bad is at a low and mediocre is more middling. Yeah, for me, mediocre with a couple of pleasant spikes in a good direction. Not the Legion of Doom's outfit or Armour Johnson's outfit. But, yeah, massively helped by Bret and Austin. And, yeah, I guess the street fight was good fun. The slight disappointment was I just thought there was a couple of matches that should have been better. For me, the tag team title match should have been better. And they should have done something better with the opener. And okay. I think that would have helped the tone of the show. It just didn't get off to a good start. It took a long time to warm up as a pay-per-view, I thought.
So where do you stand on it in terms of what they produced in the face of all the changes they had to make?
I think a lot of the credit doesn't go to the organisation so much individuals again.
Yeah.
I think that is a few individuals making good because they are talented people. And I know you're talking about the whole thing is it's not got the same planning that they'd like in the long run.
Yeah.
But you can still do short-term planning that is better than that, I think.
Pretty good, I would say, because they actually managed to produce some very high-calibre stuff. Granted, it's streamlined really into one standout match. But considering you've got changes happening all over the place, if you can still, like, pull out a five-star classic and a anarchic but admittedly enjoyable street fight match, then you're doing all right. I worry about the WrestleMania that we're going to see, where there's been loads of changes pulled around at the last minute, and whether are we going to get anything that's going to be as good as the Bret Austin match?
Oh, I wouldn't think so.
Exactly.
It's quite interesting because I post the question to our Facebook audience last week as to how you would have booked the card, you know, considering, say, Mark Merrow, who was supposed to be in 28 matches on it, was not available, and obviously Sean wasn't wrestling. And we got a kind of ton of, like, different suggestions for how people would have gone with it. And I posted my own. So what I kind of went with was Bret and Austin as the main event for the title. So yeah. I don't think I'd have, you know, fantasy booking, which is not something we do often, but I'll just sort of raise it here. Bret versus Austin for the title in the submission match. You let Bret keep the title from Final Four.
Mm.
You do Undertaker versus Sid versus Vader in a number one contenders triple threat.
Yeah.
I think adding Vader to the Undertaker-Sid dynamic might have been quite interesting.
Yeah,
I could see that.
The Chicago street fight, you don't touch. You leave exactly as it is.
Spot it's on.
Perfect. You have Rocky Maivia versus Mankind, just as a random match that's on there that gives Mankind something to do. You do Hunter versus Goldust, but for the IC title. Raises the stakes a little bit in their bout, considering that's what it had on the line in January.
Yeah.
I've got the New Blackjacks versus Furnace Lafon in a tag team number one contenders match, which was what you said earlier on you'd quite like to see. And you open with the finals of the WWF European title tournament between the British Bulldog and Owen Hart.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go. That's probably a better show.
Now, not to say that all those matches would have necessarily delivered on the day, but polishing my own booking halo here, you know, I think there's some pretty good ideas there. Mm. And you pre-show, you do like Billy Gunn versus Bart Gunn or the Sultan versus Flash Funk or the Godwins versus the Headbangers or something.
You put them all in a battle royal.
Big battle royal, I was just about to say that. That's probably
8-man tag, yeah.
Or just have a ladder match with everyone in it.
With Henry Godwin's hair on the line.
Yeah.
By no means is this an all-time great show, and it's often ranked towards the bottom end of the list when manias are collated, but I don't see how any show that contains the Bret Hart-Steve Austin match can be considered bad.
Yeah.
Although, according to Paul, he considered it mediocre, which is slightly above bad. Yes, the first hour is essentially a waste of time, and the main event isn't great, but there's a really great hour in the middle there with the I Quit match and the Chicago street fight, which exceeds all possible expectations. It's a must-see from those two perspectives and from its historical importance. We've said before that Steve Austin would have been a star with or without Bret Hart, but this match on this night certainly helped and needs to be seen. It isn't underrated. It isn't overrated. It's known as essential, and it is essential.
Yeah.
It is perhaps a catalyst for Steve Austin then.
Yes.
Well, if you were plotting sort of his timeline and you had to have significant events that happen on his way to being at the very head of the company, this is definitely a very significant point on that journey.
Match of the night in MVP, then?
The match of the night is probably going to be the submission match. because of what we've just said.
Way better than everything else.
Yeah, for being the best match on the card. MVP, I'll give to Austin for a sterling effort.
I'll say, obviously the same match. I'd probably it's a really hard choice because they give you different things in their performances. Yeah. I really enjoyed Brett's stuff. I've talked about it before. That little turn when he's kind of considering, should I wrestle Shamrock? And then just turns, I like that. I really like that.
Yeah, it's hard to say anything other than Bret Hart versus Steve Austin, isn't it? Although the Chicago street fight definitely deserves it. It does deserve a mention.
It does. It really does.
Yeah.
I just find it funny because we were both really up on this match.
Yeah.
Paul's a bit like, I don't know what's going on.
Because I think you came in when I was watching it one evening, because we all watched this show alone. This is one that none of us watched together.
Yeah.
But yeah, you came in while I was watching that.
I caught this match while you were watching it.
In fact, you came in just after the entrances, and I said, come back in here, I'm going to rewind something, just so I could show him Legion of Doom Ahmed Johnson.
Yeah,
the Bret Hart versus Steve Austin match, there's nothing more we can say about it than we haven't said already. And MVP, I'm with Paul in terms of it is really, really fucking hard to pick out of Bret Hart or Steve Austin on this one. And yeah, Paul's absolutely bang right. Both give you different things from their performances, but because I'm me, I'll pick Bret. But I was really interested as to see who we'd all pick on that. I didn't think it was a lock that either one of them would win it. I knew one of them would win it, unless you really like Marlena's outfit or something.
I did. That's a side note.
But yeah, I was interested to see who would pick who, and I haven't even written one down in mine as to who I'd picked, but going with it now and having to pick a choice, I've gone with Bret.
One of the things that I don't make my mind up, very rarely when we do the shows do I make my mind up about much of the night of MVP, because sometimes I learn other things about the matches that might influence it from our discussion.
Okay.
And one of the little details is where you're talking about the blading then, and the fact that Bret's taken control of the match and Bret's making those
decisions,
which he should do given his greater experience.
Yeah.
I think he's only right. It's not a slight on Steve Austin at all, but it's interesting that he's the one like, we're doing it.
Mullet of the night.
Slim pickings.
I didn't see him. Which match was he in?
Really slim pickings.
Slim pickings.
Yeah. It's got to be Road Warrior Animal.
That's not a mullet.
It totally is. It's a very unique mullet.
It's very unique, as in, it's not like any other mullet that you've ever seen, because it's not a mullet.
It's a relatively short mohawk that goes to the back and then expands out into a full width length of hair. It is totally a mullet. It's incredibly short on the sides. But it is slightly businesslike at the front and definitely long at the back.
It is not businesslike in any sense.
I'm sort of expecting you to just go, don't you fucking dare tell me about haircuts. Because I won't fucking tell you anything about math now, would I? And on that bombshell, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast. We are also on Twitter.
At the blood all over my face as I'm trying not to give up.
New Gen Podcast. You can, as ever, rate, review and subscribe for all of our episodes as soon as they are available on iTunes. If iTunes isn't your thing, you can also check out new episodes on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/NewGenPodcast, on Stitcher Radio or on piledriverwrestling.net. If you've just found us and want to catch up, our back catalogue is going up one by one by one on botchamania.com. And when you're over at SoundCloud, don't forget to have a listen to our commentary of the live show from Madison Square Garden. Calling Spots issue 20 is now available over at callingspots.com. This issue features a cover article on Lucha Underground that I've written, and as ever, the artwork for the front is bloody awesome. Also inside are articles and, as I always describe her, Adam's favourite Eva Marie, El Santo and Will Ospreay. That's all available for just $1.99 plus postage. Subscriptions are also available. Just finished my article for their next issue and I've seen the cover art, and again, it's bloody awesome, so make sure you get a subscription, because you'll definitely want to see it and hopefully want to read it. Episode 60, we'll see our first trip to the land of extreme. It's ECW's first foray into the world of pay-per-view. It's barely legal, 1997. No, not the one you've got on VHS, Adam.
Has Adam got one of them on the VHS?
He's definitely got a VHS called Barely Legal.
I've definitely not. VHS are dead.
DVD, then.
That's also kind of dead. I've never seen that pay-per-view, so it will be a completely new experience for me.
I've never seen that pay-per-view.
And I don't think that I would have seen anything off it, would I?
You might have seen the Terry Funk, Sandman, Stevie Richards triple threat? Ever seen that?
I don't think so. I'm guessing there might be some clips on the rise and fall of ECW.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly.
So I will have seen those clips, but I don't think I've ever seen a full match.
You looking forward to taking a trip to Philadelphia?
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Excellent. Well, we'll speak to you after WrestleMania 32. Hopefully everyone enjoys that whole time of year. Hopefully we'll see plenty of you down at the Ginger Man on Thursday the 31st of March. Thank you very much for listening. My name's Stuart Brooks. I'll see you later.
I'm Adam White. Goodbye.
I'm at Yes Paul Scrivens. Bye.